Okay, folks, I am going to call this meeting to order at 6:13 p.m. Apologies for the delay. We just had a couple of technical issues there, so we'll have that sorted out for next meeting so that we can use the microphone. Thank you again to Councillor Grohlke for letting me steal her laptop. We are most certainly within quorum then. As always, we will begin with attendance. President Kuzman.
Here.
Vice President Chellen.
Present.
Vice President Woods.
Present.
Vice President Lay.
Present.
Vice President Lau.
Present.
Governor Kelly.
Present.
Councillor Battelle.
Present.
Councillor Borden.
Present.
Councillor Mills. Councillor Hanwell.
Present.
Councillor Bannister.
Present.
Councillor Chavone.
Present.
Councillor Mohammed.
Oh, present.
Councillor Grohlke.
Yeah.
Councillor Minarski.
Present.
Councillor Valdez. Councillor Corbett. Councillor Redmond.
Present.
Councillor Hamid, Councillor Morris, Councillor Nguyen, Councillor Champagne.
Present.
Yeah, Councillor Champagne's there. Councillor Speakman.
Present.
Councillor Hodgson.
Present.
Councillor Huang.
Proxy for.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Mr. Rahman, right? Councillor Zeng.
Present.
Councillor Graham.
Present.
Councillor Binchik.
Present.
Councillor Douglas.
Yep.
Mr. Dumichel.
Yep.
Okay. With that, just a couple of announcements before we get going. First off, you'll notice on your late additions, item 6C, due to the time sensitivity of that item, I am going to make special order and move it on to the main agenda package. So you can take a look at that item, and it will happen at the appropriate time in board and committee business. Also, thank you guys for all getting... I'll get to you in just a second. Thank you for all getting here to the right place. So hopefully you didn't have too much trouble. Again, hopefully this room will be a little bit more suited to council meetings. It's a little bit smaller. It has charge stations. So if you guys are choosing not to use the paper agendas, just send me an email. Because for everyone I know that isn't taking one, I'll just print one less. So I'm always happy to print them, but if you aren't going to use them, we'll certainly try and save as many trees as we can. And if you have any other feedback about this room, you can certainly bring it to my attention or to the attention of Councillor Borden to deal with at CAC, because we'll be having to evaluate it for the fall term and decide where we want to be. Also, another note again tonight that Nicole, our admin assistant, couldn't be here, so please speak loudly so that she can hear the recording as they go. Hopefully tonight will be a little bit easier because we're in a smaller room. With that, I think that's all I have for speakers' business. President Kuzma, did you have a point of parliamentary inquiry or anything?
Yeah, point of parliamentary inquiry. I was wondering, I'd like to make an amendment to the agenda to move the MOA, the third presentation of the main agenda.
Yep.
Be the first presentation.
Okay, so that's not a point of parliamentary inquiry, but you can make it anyway. I see the food has arrived here, so what I'll do is after we deal with this motion, I'll give you guys like 3 minutes just to get up and grab some food, and then we'll, you can just even maybe set it on that table. That'd be awesome.
Thank you.
So, who's new moves to make item 2C a special order to be dealt with immediately following speaker's business. So, I'm not sure if we dealt with special orders yet, so basically just special orders can sort of change the way that we structure meetings. So quite often special orders are to move things around in the agenda for various reasons. So with that, the special order here is to move it to basically the top of the presentations list. So do we have a seconder for that special order? Councillor Mohammed, thank you very much. Let me just double check here. So that is that requires a two-thirds majority vote and is not debatable, not amendable. So all those in favor of making item 2C a special order, please raise your placards. Any opposed? Okay, that motion's carried. We will move item 2C to immediately following speaker's business. And guess what? We are immediately following speaker's business. Before we get going into this presentation, I'm going to take... Actually, I think Vice President Lay is going to also have a special order motion, so I'll take that before we go further.
Motion to suspend standing orders.
Motion to suspend standing orders, and I assume it would be a motion to suspend the relevant standing orders to allow item 7A to occur at the same meeting as a presentation on the same topic?
Yes, please.
Okay. So do I have a seconder for that motion? Vice President Woods, thank you very much. So again, this is sort of changing the rules a little bit, so it requires a two-thirds majority vote. Normally, standing order says that you can't have a motion at the same meeting as a presentation that's on the same topic. Vice President Lay, would you care to briefly introduce without going into debate? There's no debate on this, but you can introduce.
Oh, yes. We are... the motion is about the QP negotiation contract, and we want to, or we're looking to ratify it today for the time sensitivity of the contract.
Okay.
Because yeah.
When you start saying because, you're getting into debate, so I'm going to stop you there. With that, again, this requires two-thirds majority vote. All those in favor of suspending the relevant standing orders? Any opposed? That motion carries. And with that, I will take a 3-minute recess just so that you can grab food, and then we will start again in a couple of minutes here.
You have to...
Okay, folks, if there's no objection, I'm just, as the last couple people are finishing up there, I'm going to call back to order just so we don't take any more time. Thank you guys for your patience while we sort of work out the kinks with this new room. I think this new room will work better for us, but there's a couple things to sort out in terms of sound and meals and so on, so we'll make sure that's all sorted out for next meeting. In the meantime, we are going to move on. Couple of other speakers' business notes that before we leave speakers' business and go into presentations that sort of came up over the short break there. First off, just a couple of amendments that Vice President Woods is making to his motions because they haven't been introduced yet. They're still his motions, so he can sort of do whatever he wants without consent before they're introduced. That came out wrong. Anyway. But he would, you know, offer consent if the committee would... You know what? I'm just going to stop there. I'm going to stop there.
Yeah.
Okay. Item 6A, Woods moves it upon the recommendation of the Senate Nomination Committee. After that, we're going to insert the Council Administration Committee recommend the following three student representatives. So that would be... Woods moves that upon the recommendation of the Senate Nomination Committee, the Council Administration Committee recommends the following three student representatives. The next item, item 6B, in the last line there where it says in first reading, that's actually going to be scratched. So it'll just say, upon the recommendation of the Policy Committee, Students Council create the Post-Secondary Learning Act Task Force based on the attached principles. Any questions about either of those adjustments? Okay. One last note, something I forgot to mention before, but something that came up last meeting. There was a couple of questions raised about how council might be able to have some sort of a open dialogue or so on, and how council might be able to do that. So I'll just take 30 seconds to talk a little bit about it. I've had a chance to do a little bit more research on it. One of the general principles, and it's outlined in Robert's Rules, one of the general principles of parliamentary procedure is that conversation doesn't happen outside of a particular motion. The idea behind that is so that the assembly stays on track. Now, as was discussed last meeting, you can suspend the rules. The challenge with something like that is there's sort of no rules at all to govern how such a forum would take place. So you could effectively more or less have to suspend the whole book, which you could do, but then we wouldn't really know how to proceed from there. So that's not to say we can't do it, but what it is to say is that if there is desire to have that sort of function available to council, if a member of council sees that as beneficial, I would recommend that be looked at being added to standing orders so that that there are some guidelines as to how that dialogue would take place at a council meeting should that arise. And the best place to have that conversation, obviously, is at the Council Administration Committee, since they're responsible for standing orders. So if you're ever interested in having that dialogue, you can come talk to me about how that might look, and I can help you work out how that might look, but it is something that's probably best placed in standing orders, so you would talk to Councillor Gordon about adding that to the CAC agenda if you were interested. Councillor Graham, did you have a
point of parliamentary inquiry?
Yes.
Isn't there a motion you can do to have sort of like to move things into sort of a recess where it's like a conversation for a set amount of time?
You can move into a recess, which would actually sort of be outside of the meeting. So you could have the conversation, but it would sort of be offline. The recorder would be stopped. I wouldn't be moderating. It would be just sort of an open conversation. There are a couple of rules within Robert's Rules that allow you to sort of loosen the rules. So you can do things like the committee of the whole and informal consideration that take out some of the rules in terms of speaking number of speaking turns you can have and things like that, but they're all still based around the premise of debating a motion. So if you're not debating a motion, effectively there are no rules that exist, and so there's nothing really that governs it, and it's more or less going against the basic principles of Robert's Rules as a whole. Not to say we can't do that, but it's just to say that we have no rules that would govern that. Robert's Rules does talk about a concept that some committees use that's something called open forum or good of the order, which is sort of the idea behind it. And Robert's Rules, again, recommends that you write into your standing orders how that should look, because Robert's Rules doesn't define how that would look. It just suggests that it recognizes that for some committees and some legislative bodies, that's sort of a construct beneficial. So, again, happy to have that conversation with you. If you want to proceed with that, we could do that with standing orders. So, with that, we're going to move out of Speaker's business, and as of a special order, we're going to move to item 2C, 2013-2016 Memorandum of Agreement between the U of A Students' Union and QP 1368. I don't actually have listed who is sponsoring this presentation. Vice President Lay, I sort of assume. Okay, is there any objection to hearing this presentation? Seeing none, Mr. Dumichel, you have the floor until 10 after 7.
So I had one of those moments when I read my slide and I realized I used the word summary twice. How embarrassing. I want to keep this, I don't want to take too much of your time. So what we'll do is I'm going to run through a motion. There will be a motion later in the meeting. We'll be approving, hopefully, changes to the collective agreement we have with our union. Josh will be leading that discussion. Because I have to leave after this. But I would like to invite you, as I go through this, if you have any questions, to just pop your hand up and ask. It's easier than waiting for your hand, and we're probably a bit faster. I do promise you, you're going to learn some things that you didn't know, though, about how we handle our staff. Some of it's kind of interesting. All right. So, what this is we met for a couple over the period of a few months earlier this year with some representatives from QP Local, and we achieved agreement on what the upcoming collective agreement for the next few years should be between us and QP. These changes now have to be ratified by both the QP membership, which did ratify it, I think a week and two Fridays ago, and now by you before it can take effect. So I'm going to run through the changes very briefly. One of the things that we have that you may realize, and may or not realize, is that only some of our staff are covered by the union. So we have what's called an exemption list that's written into the contract in Section 203. And we updated that list. That list hadn't been updated in a long time. It's a very thorny thing when you talk to the union about who exactly should and shouldn't be in the union. They've agreed with us now, though, formally, that student services should not be part of the union. But they also felt that, and we agreed with them, that there were a few positions in some of our central services departments that we hadn't included in the union that probably should be. That's the graphic designer, a position called marketing assistant position. And there's also a position that falls under another union member, Nicole, from Intakers, that wasn't union, and we felt that should probably be a union position as well. That won't result in any huge changes for counselors. What it will mean, though, is if you're a chair and you cancel your meeting with too short a notice, we're going to have to pay the minute table for 3 hours of work regardless. So try to make your meetings. incumbents in general in substantially similar positions, at least for the first two, the graphic designer marketing assistant position, they're going to be grandfathered in. So we're not going to force them to change the terms of their contract. I'm not even actually really sure we could. There's a bunch of legal considerations when you do that. Second thing we did is we increased redundancy pay. We never, this is very rarely in growth, but basically occasionally, like when we shut down SU Records, we made positions in the SU redundant. When you make them redundant, you give them a payout, severance pay essentially, for an amount that is a quote graduated based upon how long they've worked with the student's union. We increased the maximum payout from 24 to 26 weeks. In addition to base redundancy pay, we also have, if you're with the SU for like more than, I think, 15 years, you can start to accumulate a retirement benefit that's paid out to your retirement. So if you're declared redundant, it used to be that you didn't get that retirement benefit. The retirement benefit's a newer benefit that we added a few cycles ago. Now, if you've been with the SU for 20 years and your position becomes redundant, it felt only appropriate that we would give you a retirement bonus as well. We've increased shift differential. Some of you may not realize this, but I'll explain I'll explain as simply as I can. We run three shifts of our facility staff, and three 8-hour shifts essentially during the day. So what we do is people who work inconvenient shifts, so a shift that starts in the afternoon and ends late in the evening, or starts in the evening and ends the next morning, we pay them a bit extra. It's a night shift, basically, premium. And we have two shifts like that, an afternoon shift and an overnight shift. We've increased the shift differential 5% to reflect the effect of inflation since we last set it, I think, two cycles ago. We also have a thing. You may find interesting, more interesting. In the late 90s, the SU was actually pretty, hand-to-mouth on cash. And when we were negotiating these agreements, we didn't have any money to increase the amount that we paid our staff. So instead, what we introduced is we gave them vacation days. We call them floater days. So in our agreement, and I should also point out that most of the terms of the benefits laid out in our agreement, we apply to everybody in the organization. So even though this is a union agreement, these changes we will apply to everybody who works for us. So we'll apply to Craig, for example, in his job. Because there was no money, they decided instead we'll give you some vacation days. We call them floater days. There's a winter floater day and a summer floater day. They're time. They fall. You can claim them in a particular period of time in the year. In the winter, it's through the winter. And in the summer, it's through the summer. And these have to be used. If you don't use them up, you lose them. But it's a nice little thing that actually increases the amount of vacation time we give our staff. Previously, we weren't allowing those floater days to be used to extend existing vacation days. So if you wanted to go to Bali for 3 weeks, and you had 3 weeks, because you had 3 weeks, take 15 days vacation, great. But you couldn't take 16 days and use your floater day. Now you can. We also changed our appointment time. We also give up to 21 hours a year for our staff to go to appointments. Because, you got the dentist, you got to go see the dentist, and you don't really want to burn a whole day. So we let them use a special kind of leave called appointment time. We also found, though, from our staff that there were a few things that they weren't getting time off for, which they had to do during working hours, and that was veterinary services, financial planning, and legal services. The financial planning one was particular interest to us because that was a focus, which I'm going to come to in a bit, of the negotiations for us. We wanted to help our staff be more successful in the long term with their retirement savings and things like that. So it makes sense to add financial planning to appointment time. This is the big one. This is what we're going to be paying over the next 3 years in terms of increases and what we're doing with the retirement savings plan we have for some of our employees. First, we are going into a time when we're making a lot of changes in our business, so we wanted to be cautious when we set our increases, but also, over the last two or three cycles, we've actually been setting our increases at a reasonable rate, 1.5-2%. You'd think this was fine. Except over the last number of years, inflation has been so low that wages have actually increased at double the rate of inflation. So we want to take that into account. We can't afford to continue to keep out doubling the rate of inflation in our increases. So we set up a more conservative pay increase of 0.75% for this coming year, 1% for next year, and 2% for the year after. That's not all we're going to pay, though. For people who are participating in the registered retirement savings plan that we have, we will be increasing the rate at which they contribute and the rate that we contribute. So, for example, out of my salary, they take there's a deduction that takes a certain percentage of my income off, puts it in an RSP. Okay, out of the money that I get. That happens right away. The SU then matches that amount of money, and it goes into an RSP. Currently, that's just a little bit less than 5% on each side that's given. We want to raise that to 7%. So it will be 7% from the ASU, 7% from the employee themselves, so that they're saving 14% a year instead of what it comes out to be, I think it's 9.95% that they're currently saving. And I'll explain why that is in a second. What we had to do, though, to make sure this was going to work, is you never want to cut a deal where people take home less money in the wallet at the end of the month. So we had to make sure the pay increase would offset the additional contribution. This additional contribution does not apply to all staff. It only applies to ones who are participating in the RRSP plan. We'll talk about this a little bit more because I'm actually very proud of this. This is going to improve the future retirements of our employees immeasurably. And this is why. When we moved to having a self-directed RRSP we were originally in the public service pension plan in the 80s, and we got kicked out because we didn't really meet the criteria. That's when we last set our rates for how much the employee puts in and how much the employer puts in at that 4.975% rate. Here's the thing now. Since then, the public service pension plan has realized their employees aren't saving enough money. So they've actually raised each side's contribution, they just did one just now, to 11.7%. So now they're 23% of someone's compensation, if you work for public service, is going to a pension plan. I think that's a little high. They're a pension plan, we do RRSPs, the rates of return are a bit better, but we did feel that we had fallen behind in terms of what people need to save. And we wanted to, it was really important both for us and the union to ensure that our staff have a secure retirement. So over the 3 years of the contract, we're slowly going to grow that 4.975 rate to 7%. So they'll be putting in 7%, and we'll be putting in 7%. So it'll be 14% contribution to people's retirement funds. Even while the total take-home pay that they take home, it will still increase every year. So it'll be off. So it's going to be pretty good. I'm personally very proud of this. And let me give you a little more of a reason why. Oh, my battery's low tonight. This doesn't look like it, but the gap at any point in here is over 45% increase. And it is over 45% higher. This red represents how much more they're adding to their retirement savings. And it doesn't look like it's where the grass is constructed, but it's actually 45% more than the lower level. So that's a big difference. And over time, it does two things. One is, if you work the same amount of time, you're going to retire a lot richer. Or if you don't want to, if you don't need the maximum amount of money, you'll be able to retire earlier. Because at this point here, if you just wanted to save under this scenario $500,000, you work about 30 years with the students' union. The way it is now, you'd only work about 25. This is another example of it. So if you're trying to reach 400,000, $500,000, or $1 million, this is how long it takes you at the current RRSP rates, based on some assumptions about income and that kind of thing, and how long it takes under the new rates. And you see, we cut a lot of time off, cut about 5 years off of how long it takes an employee to get to a certain point. And what I think is really interesting, if you were to start today at age 25, how old are you, Craig?
25.
Right. And if you're making $40,000 today, and say that you never actually move up, you just stay in that same position, you just get your increments every couple of years, and you work until you're 65, you'll retire in money. So we're pretty happy with the net impact of these changes. We also made a change to the meal allowance. If a staff employee has to work unscheduled overtime, we have this allowance they can have for meals. This hadn't been adjusted since, I think, the early 90s, so we've upped those amounts slightly. This actually hasn't been used by anybody in a couple of years, so it's not going to have a big financial impact on the UC. The union was very concerned about their members being allowed to honor picket lines around subs. So if NASA was to pick a sub, they want to be able to respect those lines. We were concerned, well, look, if everybody does that, two things. One is we'll make it hard to run the SU. Okay, we can muddle through that. But we're not going to pay you to sit at home because it'll turn into just basically a vacation. And that's not what we want to do. So we compromised around the idea that they won't be paid, but we're not going to take any sanctions about anybody who honors a legal picket line around our building. And finally, we did some health plan changes. We changed some provisions of it. We used to have a per-visit maximum for many of all the categories except psychologists of $20. Well, if you go to Cairo, it's only $40, $45, so we're starting to cover half of it. We got rid of that per-visit maximum, and we increased the total amount that an employee could claim on our plan for these kinds of things from $400 to $500. And that's it. The rest of the changes are typically just editorial. I think one of them is we renumbered everything from one format of numbering to another, an entire section that's in there. But that's the summary of the major changes. Does anyone have any questions?
Counselor Sigmund.
Mine was from about the shifts that were up there. Can you go back to that? I didn't get what that was actually saying. Yeah, so that is that like the time and from your, let's say you're off at 11 p.m. one day, then it's like a certain amount of hours before you can be scheduled again?
No, shift differential is if I'm scheduled to work 11 to 7
mm-hmm.
and I work that full shift, I get an extra dollar an hour added to my paycheck.
Oh, because it's a night shift?
Yeah, because it's a night shift.
I see.
So now it'll be $1.05.
That's how much.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was just curious, just to confirm, so for minute takers, that includes recording secretaries for...
Yeah, that's what I'm calling them here. We haven't decided on a final title yet, but that's the idea.
Any other questions? Vice President Chong?
Mr. Speaker, by curiosity, is it commonplace for bar staff to be covered by the union?
Nope.
So why do we do it?
I don't know. Yeah, it was a big. There were lots of fights about who should be unionized and who shouldn't. Back at the back in the 70s, when we started the negotiation, actually, they came in and they said, in the founding charter of the union, the only people exempted were the projectionist. Except that wasn't true. We went and looked into it. Like that, they honestly thought that was true, but we looked into there were fights years later about whether to put part-timers into the thing and all that, into the union. So there has always been a bit of a back and forth about that. Once they're in, which is why we're really cautious about it, almost impossible to get them out. It's really hard to get someone out of a union without giving major concessions to the union. We're a small organization, a small bargaining unit. It's just crazy. So that's why they're in there. We do get some. They are reasonable though. They do give us some concessions, like servers, because they're tipped. They don't have a grid like everybody else does. So they don't get the same. They're kind of at a bit lower scale because of the tips than other staff.
Any other questions? Yes, Councilor Bincher.
Are you foreseeing any circumstances in the future that might put us in a situation where we need to remove any workers from the union?
We are changing the configuration of our businesses, but we're not declaring anybody redundant. We go out of our way to try to avoid that. So, for example, Cram Dunk is closed for at least a year. It may make her, because people like the donut separate. It may make a resurrection when we finish the renovations. But the person who worked there isn't being declared redundant. We've just moved them to a different operation, so they still have a job with us, with an equivalent position. The only time I'm aware that it was used was, it may have been used when we closed down the plant. I don't know. I don't think so. It was used when I was president and we closed down the record store. I remember that. That was in 1991.
Councilor Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm interested in this joint gender neutral job evaluation.
Oh, yes.
And it says it's scheduled to be completed by August 1st, 2013. So I was wondering if you could just speak to the status of that.
So, 20 years ago, the SU and the union agreed with each other. And this is a true story. So within 2 years, I'm going to do my horn over here. We would do this joint gender job evaluation. And the point being that you try to, you make everybody who works for the union fill out a questionnaire, and you grade, ask them a series of questions, and you try to find a way to equate work of different types. You try to put value to it so that you can make sure that people are getting paid an equal amount for work of equal value, because there used to be a problem with gender disparity in pay scales. A secretary might not make as much as a janitor. That continued in our on the books. That letter was renewed for 2 year periods every year up until two years ago, where we actually renewed it, and then we actually started the process. And so for the past almost 2 years, I think, we've been engaged in this process working with the union. There's a committee that meets and talks and has developed a questionnaire. They've surveyed all our staff, and they're just now collating the results to try to figure out how to equate different positions. It's a point scale, so if you're familiar with the way the university does their stuff, where they assign each position points, and they base the salary based on that, that's what they're doing right now. The union has different motivations than we do. Our motivation is to try to keep this as cost neutral as possible while ensuring that we can make the grid more fair. And we also have certain market forces that aren't typical in a unionized environment. So right now they're developing kind of a framework that they'll present to me and to the union president. It's a committee that I'm not actually active on. And then we'll discuss, okay, what is this telling us, this information, and how do we implement it so that we are making sure that we're paying everybody fairly. It's a very, very complicated process. A lot of the union staff didn't like doing the work. They had the questionnaire, actually. They got kind of annoyed at us. But we think it's important that we try to make sure that we're embodying the values of equity and fairness that are core to our organization.
Any other questions?
Does that answer your question?
I was just like, so it just the process of actually doing this just got started 2 years ago.
Yeah, they talked about it for 20 years, and we finally got around it. And we will have it done. The next question will be, first question we'll have when we get the report is, does everybody agree with the results of the report? And the second question will be, what would implementation look like? And when that stuff gets done, we'll bring it back to council.
Do you have a timeline for that?
I would like to say by the winter term, but I can't say that. These things sometimes take longer than we expect.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much, Mr. Dubichel. With that, we will move on to item 2A, University of Alberta Budget Primer, presented by President Kuzmu, Vice President Woods, Vice President Chellen, sponsored by President Kuzmu. Is there any objection to hearing this presentation? Seeing none, we will go ahead with this presentation once the presenters are ready to go up here.
It's not a laptop or anything. So slam your gavel. No, I think we should be good. Although I might need to.
And if you are grabbing food and whatnot, if you could just try and be as quiet as you could, and then we can kind of keep going with the presentation, and you can kind of see me.
Guys.
No, it's just
I don't know.
There are either side
of it. No, both sides.
Are you going to take questions during the presentation? Because you can't take them from people until.
Afterwards.
Okay.
Oh, so that reminds me. William, we'll just suspend standing orders after your presentation, okay? Yeah, you.
Yeah. I feel great.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, buddy. Hey, monies. Or lack thereof.
Should maybe update that.
He was actually our director of research like a long time ago. God, I was mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Okay, so it's 7:03. See you up till 7:33.
Cool. So, thanks a lot for giving us a chance to present to you guys about the university's budget. And thanks a lot for all the different faculty association representatives for swinging by. That's really appreciated. Well, some in different capacities and hats. But, oh, did you take this, Chris? Okay, sweet. So, anyways, today, so why are we doing this, essentially? Next council meeting, we'll have Martin Ferguson-Pelt, Vice President Academic and the Acting Provost for the institution. Essentially show up to council, and it'll be an hour-long Q&A. He doesn't really have a presentation in mind, he's told me. He said, I think it'd be best if, your counselors could just ask me whatever questions, and I can be here for an hour, and that's it. So, with that being said, we wanted to prep council with whatever questions, with the kind of information you guys need in order to ask very important questions to the provost. And we've kind of covered some of this stuff during our council retreat, et cetera, but some of you folks may have not been present. So with that being said, we figured we'd give you another presentation. It'll be a little bit more in-depth, and you'll have a little bit more updated information. But for the most part, we want to make sure you guys are as prepared as possible to ask really awesome questions to the acting provost, because it's a pretty rare opportunity to have a one-hour Q&A. So with that being said, we'll go ahead. There'll be a couple things that we'll be covering today. We'll talk about the provincial government focusing on education, the university's budget specifically, student fees, tuition. We'll cover the quality of education very briefly, and a brief note on student finances. So Dustin, Adam, and I will kind of go back and forth between the different presentations. And that's essentially it. So when we're talking about the jurisdiction for post-secondary education, it's a shared jurisdiction between the provincial and federal governments. So if you look at Section 93 of the Federal Constitution Act, it says the following, and for each province, the legislature may exclusively make laws in relation to education. So that one word, may, is really important, because that means they have a shared responsibility. With that being said, the provincial government takes a large role in terms of funding and actually, the regulations surrounding post-secondary education, whereas the federal government's really a lot more laid back. They provide some cash transfers to provinces for post-secondary education, and on top of that, they also have a whole bunch of funding for student aid and research. So there's that. Within the province, we have something called the Post-Secondary Learning Act. It's pretty much the act that governs post-secondary institutions within the province. And within that act, there's no reason why we have a students' union. The government says there needs to be an association that represents students at each of these institutions. Also in Section 93, ironically enough.
Well, that's actually really neat. Within that, they talk about financial supports and the legislative framework. So that's essentially it when it comes to jurisdiction and legislation surrounding post-secondary education. The main point of this slide is saying there's a shared role between the provincial and federal government. The provincial government plays a bigger role. So when we talk about the provincial support for post-secondary education, what are we talking about? So there are four different ways institutions are funded by the provincial government. So first we have the Access to the Future Fund. And it's essentially a really big endowment fund. It currently has, I believe, $1.35 billion in it. And it's essentially a big fund of which, the government makes interest off of, quite a hefty amount of interest. And it has two purposes. It has something called a Renaissance Fund, and it has an Innovation Fund. So the Renaissance Fund is essentially saying, hey, institutions, if you guys fundraise, we will match whatever you fundraise, essentially, from donors, et cetera. So institutions are super stoked. They're saying, wow, if I get, a buck from Stephanie, all of a sudden the government's going to give me a dollar as well, right? However, this actually got, too popular when this was kind of, made in 2005, and it actually got oversubscribed, and the provincial government hasn't really been giving their money to the institutions yet for this. The universities are stuck, and institutions are stuck in an odd spot because they told donors, hey, government's going to be giving us extra money by you donating, even though the government isn't doing that yet.
And 24% of that is supposed to be going for scholarships as well. So the other is supposed to go to primarily infrastructure, et cetera. And there's also the Innovation Fund, which is for research, and that's just supporting research. Now, in addition to that, universities get, they have their own capital projects, and they get capital funds to let's say, build buildings, to deferred maintenance and all these other issues. And that doesn't really affect, let's say, the quality of an education as much. I mean, it's important for us to have really high-tech classrooms, desks and Tori that's actually functional. I mean, that's like all really good stuff to have. But it doesn't actually pay our professors and our teachers. So there's capital projects. That's somewhere, I think, for the university's budget for that, something like $76 million a year, approximately. There's also research support. Federal government, well, the provincial government has something called Alberta Innovates, and that's primarily where a lot of the research dollars are given to profs for doing research and etc. and graduate students. And there's a lot of the research funding comes from the federal government as well. So, but where we saw a lot of the big cuts happen was the operating budget, right? The operating budget is essentially what is the day-to-day running of the institution itself. And that's the really important part that really impacts like the day-to-day lives of students here on campus, right? The amount of professors and teachers that we have, the kind of programs that we have available to us, the kind of services. And that's the point that's kind of the thing you want to focus more on. That was a 7.2% cut that took place, and that's the most amount of cash the university actually gets. So the provincial government spends around $2.6 trillion each year just for operating grants. And the use, huh? Billions. That's pretty big. My bad. $1 billion. And with the Carey Institution, so Carey Institutions is the University of Alberta, Lethbridge, Calgary, Athabasca. They take $1.17 billion off of that. So they take around half of that. So that's something that might be interesting to hear. And yeah, over time, those budgets have actually really increased in the past decade or so. It's just a matter of have they actually kept up the pace, and that's kind of the debate the institutions have with the university. They're saying, yeah, you're increasing it, but you're not keeping up with the pace that we really need you to be increasing it at. So that's something important to keep in mind. I kind of talked about capital grants already at the university. Now, their Campus Alberta grants, which is kind of their operating grants that the university gets from the institution, is $548 million that they get from the provincial government. And that's quite a hefty amount of cash. And that's how much they got this year. So, and with capital grants, what are some of the things they spend on? Like I mentioned earlier, there's infrastructure, maintenance of buildings, building new buildings. Those are all pretty big things of importance as well. Research support. There's a federal government, so there's, I don't know if some of you folks have heard of SHRC, NSERC, those tri-council funding agencies. Essentially, have one for the social sciences, one for science, one for health-related fields, and they're the ones who fund a lot of the research. Again, it's not really too relevant to Students' Council. We don't really talk about it that much, but figured you guys, you folks might be interested in learning that. So there's also provincial roles, other innovates. Now, Dustin will cover more about this section on the budgets at the UVA and kind of the budget process. So
the university is involved in an integrated budgeting planning process. That means budgeting is going on all the time at the university. What does it look like? There's a small working group called the Budget Working Group that meets to discuss various expenditures as well as revenues. They're fed information from the university's VP, ABP Risk Management Services, that gives an indication of key budget drivers, things like retention, recruitment, government budgets, etc. They make decisions on budgetary allocations, send those decisions to the Strategic Initiatives Group. That's a group consisting of university associate vice presidents. During the same time, there will be any changes to either tuition, rent, or mandatory non-instructional fees. Students will be voted through the budget advisory committees. The proposal then goes to a senior internal administrative committee, the president's executive committee. There's two of them. That consists of the president and then the VPs of the university. Once they have come to a collective agreement on the university budget, they then forward it to the university's governance process. And that's when we start to see
real numbers. It goes through it twice. It will go through GFC Academic Planning Committee, Board Finance and Property Committee, and the Board. Petro sits on all three of those. And it's approved as part of something called the Comprehensive Institutional Plan. I will try not to put you asleep. What does it look like? It's a year-long budgeting process. They typically spend the first 2 months in the summer consulting with deans, department chairs. They have authority over budgets in departments or in faculties. And the summer is primarily spent doing research and consultation with deans, and also research again on those key budget drivers. Where do we see recruitment going a year from now? How many international students do we see us getting a year from now? What do we see happening with oil prices a year from now? Then over the course of the fall semester, the university really undergoes a hefty period of consultation. They start drafting the actual budget, going through numbers. Ralph looks like he's about to pass out. They draft actual numbers. They'll go and bring tuition consultation documents to the SDU. They'll approve tuition in December through the Board of Governors up to BFPC. And then in the winter semester, they will finalize the budget through governance. And that process that I showed you earlier. If you notice, point two happens pretty close to the end of the budgeting cycle. That's when the government announces their budget. Typically, they tend to stick with previous promises. Enterprise and Advanced Education does set a forecast of the Campus Alberta Operating Grant that Petros talked about earlier. They set a forecast for it for the next 3 years. They typically stick within that. What we had this year is a situation where at the very end of that process, step number two, the university received a reduction of 7.2%, or 9% on what they were expecting, because they were expecting a 2% increase. And that caused them to have to essentially redo all of this process in about 2 months for the 2013-2014 budget, which was approved about a month ago at the board as part of the academic or as part of the comprehensive institutional plan. Michael Patrick.
Cool. So, like I mentioned earlier, the provincial government has those four different pools of which they fund institutions. Right? We have research. We have the operating, we have the Access to the Future Fund, and we also have operating capital, Access to the Future Fund, research. Right? Now, when we look at the university's budget, they have four different budgets, right? They have an operating budget. That's the money, that's like the big chunk of money that they get from the provincial government, also known as the Campus Alberta Grants. That's the one that's $500+ million. There's the capital budget. So again, that's for buildings, infrastructure, deferred maintenance, etc. There's a restricted research budget. So this cash is, for specific research projects, etc. And it's just for that. Like you want to take $1 million from a research project and pay a prof. To, let's say, teach a course. You can't do that. That's not allowed. It's restricted, and the provincial government gives it to you for a certain need. And there's also an ancillary budget. Now, the ancillary budget is essentially ancillary units, and what's ancillary? It essentially pays for itself, right? So the operating budget is essentially a really flexible budget. Capital budget, with capital, so if you were to look at it, capital and restricted budget are all very restricted. Like, you actually can't all of a sudden, the university's building more buildings. Like, why can't they just take $20 million from, like, this new building and pay a professor or something? In that instance, they've most likely received a grant from the federal government for that specific project, right? So you can't just, it's not as easy as, like, putting something from your savings account to your checking account, right? It's a little bit more complex than that. However, with ancillary budget and operating budget, it's a little bit more flexible. So ancillary budget, that's something like residences, right? Let's say it's a bookstore. This is stuff that pays for itself, right? So they'll make a budget of whatever, but they'll make sure that the rent is enough so it pays for itself. If there's any profits from the ancillary budget, they can move it to the operating budget, okay? What else is paid for ancillary budget? The UPass. The university subsidizes 1/6 of the UPass price, so that all that money is coming from the parking revenues, another ancillary unit, right? Now, this is kind of going off a tangent right now. So the university is saying, hey, like, we can't subsidize that much anymore. Why? Because parking revenues are going down. But we were planning on taking some cash from the operating budget and putting it here to pay for the UPass. With the budget, with the operating budget being slashed 7.2%, we don't have that flexibility anymore, and the parking revenues really suck. So what are we going to do? So that kind of gives you a better understanding. Essentially, capital budget restricted and research budget is very restricted. Operating budget is very flexible, and ancillary budget like parking, residences, bookstore, etc., that stuff pays for itself. So, and what do you call all of this? Consolidated budget. So it's all consolidated into one. Hopefully that's a good description. Consolidated budget is like $1.7 billion. It's pretty big. And that includes research funding, that includes capital grants that they get. That's pretty much it. Is there any more notes I can make here? Okay. Yeah. So here's essentially a breakdown of the consolidated budget, and it talks about percentages and how much cash they receive from each of these different stakeholders. So where the two main revenues for the government, for the institution, gets most of its cash from the provincial government. So the federal government gives cash to the provincial government, the provincial government gives it to the institutions for operating. And it also gets most of its cash from students, right? Where that's 17.6%. Now, something that you have to keep in mind is that, you know, sometimes you may hear the argument, well, students, you know what, if you look at these kind of slides, students are paying way less than they should be. If you look, let's say, back in the days, students were footing the bill for 20% of it, and we should increase tuition as a result. There's a couple things that you should keep in mind. This is a consolidated budget. This includes capital projects. This includes research, of which, you know, for instance, if someone gets a big big grant from the federal government, like what does that have to do with you getting an education, right? There's a lot of other tasks that the university does, of which that doesn't really impact your day-to-day education, right? So you should be talking about the operating budget. The operating budget is the budget that actually educates you, that pays for your professor's salaries, for the instructors. So that's a really nuanced argument. And when you look at the budget, when you look at the operating budget, students are actually, there's a larger increase, right? Because all of a sudden, you're not having these revenues from, let's say, research or wherever it is, right? So keep that in mind. If you're ever having that debate, ask someone, well, is it the consolidated or the operating budget, right, in terms of percentage? And that's usually a good way to kind of win a debate. And there's also other things to keep in mind. Do you have a question?
Yeah, what is amortization and its deferred capital contribution?
So like, deferred capital contribution versus that?
Amortization and deferred capital contribution under revenues.
Under revenues?
Yeah.
Okay, oh, I see. Very good. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not an accountant, so I'll pass this either around to Josh if they want to correct me, but strict accounting requires you to account for both amortization as well as capital expenses, so maintenance of buildings and decreased value of supplies owned. Those are accounting expenses where essentially the university is required to account for a revenue because they aren't paying to upkeep their buildings, for example. And so that's the deferred capital contribution. Josh, what happened with amortization?
Amortization. I googled the definition. So the direct one is the reduction of the value of an asset by prorating its cost over a period of years. So what that means is that if you buy a house, for example, you're gonna break down the cost per year, pretty much.
If it was like an amortization expense, is that like, and it's like a mortgage payment almost, like some sort of installment on something that you're paying for over the long term?
being said, it's recorded as revenue. Craig, do you want to take it? My understanding is...
Well, all I was going to say is effectively an amortization is a representation that you have to either have an expense or a revenue in a certain year that provides benefit over multiple years. So you effectively, on paper, spread that expense or revenue out over multiple years. So that's what you have. I think it's actually amortized deferred capital contribution. I don't think it's two separate things. That's what it's trying to say.
Thank you.
So it's representative of capital contributions that have been received in past years, I think.
We should take questions later, though, Pedro, because otherwise we're going to have time at the end of it.
Okay. Sure. Well, make sure you track your questions and so we don't forget about it. But okay. That's essentially it. And another point to keep in mind as well is here's some more information. So the there's a 7.2% cut to the operating budget, but the university was expecting a 2% increase, so it kind of budgeted for that. So that's a 9.2 is kind of what they say they lost, including expectations, but it's really 7.2%. And that equates to something like $40 to $60 million.
63. So 9% is 63,
7.2% is 43. Yeah. So that's essentially. So when we're having these conversations of programs being cut, et cetera, it all goes down to the operating budget. And something that's really important to keep in mind is 20%. Like, again, talking about that argument of, like, how much you pay for your education. Really focus on the operating grants, operating budget part of it, and that's how much are you actually paying for your education, right? So we have professors who have two jobs. One is to teach us. The other job they do is to do research, right? And the research side of it, be frank, really doesn't impact us as strongly, right? It's not actually, publishing something in a journal isn't directly correlated with, like, how much of a better educational experience we're going to be getting. So there's a lot of indirect costs associated with, let's say, professors doing research, and you kind of have to, that's a little bit more nuanced, we have to, like, look at the numbers. But I think our time is running out.
You have 9 minutes.
Can we make a motion to suspend standing orders?
Yeah. So that you can make two different types of motions. You can either basically have no time limit imposed, or you could extend to a certain period. So feel free to pick whichever you choose.
So can we extend it for half an hour?
So extend it for an additional half hour.
Yeah.
So President Kuzma will make a motion to suspend standing orders to extend the presentation to 1 hour in length. Do we have a seconder for that? Councillor Zhang, thank you very much. Requires a two-thirds majority vote. All those in favor? Let's check how these guys are doing here. All those opposed? Okay, that motion carries. So you have until 8:03.
Okay. Cool. Well, I should move on.
Cool. So I'll just move back quickly. So Pedro talked consolidated budget, great, but what we really want to look at is the operating budget. That's what should be primarily paying for your teaching, learning, as well as the overall operating costs of the university. This is a great diagram, but what we'd like to do is show you a diagram for this, for the operating budget. That's really what the money, where the money is going to pay for your education and where it's being spent for your education. That being said, we can't show you that graph because we don't have it. The university recently changed its practices where it will only release the consolidated budget, not the operating budget. So we don't actually know the costs and revenues that are related primarily to the teaching and research mission of the university. This back here talks about things like the amount that we're paying workers to build PAW, accounting terms, things like that. So, but if we go back to that diagram, we know that revenues decreased by about $43 million over the past year. So you're all smart. What you're all thinking is, how are we going to deal with that? The obvious balance to a decrease in revenue is a decrease to expenditures. And so what I wanted to talk about just briefly is there are some restrictions. If you go back to that previous graph, by and large, the biggest chunk of expenditures are on salaries and benefits. If you go to the operating budget, it's probably something like 70-80% salaries and benefits. When you go to particularly non-equipment-heavy faculties, arts, law, the other social sciences, they've got budgets, operating budgets of 80%, 90%, 95% salaries and benefits. But there's some flexibility restrictions around them. Just the way the SU has unionized staff, so does the university. There's two primary unions, that for academic staff and that for non-academic staff. They both have a number of collective agreements with the university that provide limitations on reduction of expenditures. First, the benefits package has been negotiated until 2015. So both non-academic and academic staff will be getting raises approximately 1.5% until 2015. That's part of the agreement that can be changed unless the unions go to the university and say, look, we're willing to take a 0% increase to our salaries. The alternative to a reduction in salary is a reduction in people. Being a university means that our contracts are somewhat different. Our academic staff primarily are tenured academic staff, which means, in a sense, that they can't be fired. Those are the professors, assistant professors, associate professors. They aren't ever fired by the university. A big chunk of paid staff, though, that could be affected by a budget cut is something called contract academic staff. They teach approximately 43% of undergraduate classes. They're still a doctor, they still have a PhD, but you'll notice in their title they aren't a professor. They aren't engaging in a 40% research, 40% teaching, 20% service split. They are primarily teachers. Their contracts are either 1 or 3 year rotating contracts. The long story short, this year we'll likely see fewer contract academic instructors teaching undergraduate courses. And those are people who are hired primarily to teach. They're hired primarily on their interest and quality teaching. What are other expenditure things that we have affecting us this year? Number one, salaries are going up for the next 3 years. We also have benefits going up and for both academics and non-academics, so their drug coverage, other federally mandated employment benefits, those are increasing over the next 3 years. In addition, the university also has something called merit increments. So for those academic staff that teach, and I'm not sure as far as non-academic staff, each year they get a pay raise based on their performance in research or teaching. And so professors are still entitled to a pay increase next year. What I'm really saying is we aren't going to see much of a change in expenditures for salaries over the next, at least over this current year. Number one, it's very, very difficult to do, and number two, salaries and benefits are increasing. Where else can we cut expenditures? Utilities is probably the second big. There's supplies and sundries, and you'll see that budget line cut substantially in the operating budget, I suspect. I don't know. You haven't seen it. The next biggest chunk of the pie is utilities. The university runs what's called a district energy system. We generate our own power. It's incredibly cost-efficient, and it's very, very difficult to reduce that expenditure anymore. Where is it easy to reduce expenditures? Scholarships. Sometimes donors that donate money will provide restrictions on where they want to see their money going, but in cases where they don't, that's a place that the university can cut their funds.
So, we talk a lot about, we've heard a lot about the consolidated budget as compared to operating budget. One thing that I want to for us to keep in mind before looking at our own tuition numbers is that, and it was brought up earlier by Petros, just that at the end of the day, when we talk about consolidated budget and we talk about general university revenue and expenditure, and there's going to be a lot of budget debates about each one needing to pay more tuition and higher fees, remember that you came here to pay for your education. You did not come here to pay for it. When you got accepted, you did not sign a contract saying you would help fund university research. You did not say you'd help fund university building expansions. With that being said, though, our university over the past few years, especially with the province giving, I'm not going to say generous, but they've usually gotten a raise anywhere from either they get the same or they get around a 2 to 3% increase from the province. So they have always looked at ways to expand their budget, trying to expand research, trying to expand. You've seen buildings sprung up everywhere on campus the last few years. They've really been in, spend money mentality. And how have they financed that if they've only been getting 0 to 2% cuts? Well, over the years, they've raised tuition and fees. It's been quite a stagnant thing. If you look at the rates from 1990 to now, I mean, we're paying quite ridiculous differential from back in the day, you might say. If you're wondering why these numbers are out of line, I'll talk about market modifiers in a little bit here. But just in general, commenting on how we've seen our tuition rates really go up to such increments over the last few years. So, looking at, again, back at the PSLA, and one thing that's really interesting when we look at mandatory non-instructional fees and tuition, the PSLA grants are board the power to set tuition and fees subject to other limits outlined in the regulation. So, essentially, the board has every right to set tuition. At the moment, though, tuition is set to CPI. Does anybody see anything really interesting about this second paragraph here that if you've been around the SU for a while, you might find interesting, because this is the actual language from the PSLA saying that they can assess, they can charge us things. Is there anything missing in your opinion?
The costly?
Yeah, mandatory fees. There is no mention in the PSLA of mandatory fees. That's something that we might be working on a little bit later, but it's just something to keep in mind. But our institutions, when the tuition cap was set in 2009, they decided, oh, well, we're just going to charge these extra fees. We're going to say they're not tuition, and we're just going to charge them. And that's what they've done. And that's how they've kind of kept up the rates since the tuition cap came in, to kind of continue the spending patterns that they've been on over the last several years. And now that we've seen the cut, it's kind of a question of what's going to happen, because the tuition cap is still in place. They can't touch it. They did raise mandatory fees, but just by CPI, probably because the government promised they weren't going to put the cuts on the back of students. By raising our fees, we could have all said they're putting it on the back of students. We would have been right, and then who knows what would have happened. So they've been smart by just raising their fees by CPI at this point. But with that being said, it doesn't make up for all that they've lost, which is why the tuition cap is incredibly important. This is something that we're going to be hopefully working on getting legislated in PSLA this year. I'm going to be working very hard on this, because it ensures that at the moment, the tuition cap is not set in stone. It's ministerial discretion. So the moment that Minister Luke has it, says, I don't like the tuition cap very much. We're just going to throw that out the window. They can charge us whatever they want. They can raise the tuition by, if they want to, 20%. I'm not saying it'll happen, but it might. So, tuition fee regulation mandates that our institutions must provide students council each year a statement of anticipated tuition fee increases for a four-year period, hold consultations with our students council to discuss any proposed tuition increases, and have at least two tuition consultation meetings with our council per year. These do happen. With that being said, though, it very much depends on your definition of consultation, which is something that we're currently working on with the university. It's come up a lot in the past year. What is the definition of consultation? For them, often coming into a room with us like this and telling us, well, this is what we've done, that's consultation. And then just moving forward with it. So it's a matter of holding them accountable to this very broad definition of accountability, I guess you could say, and ensuring that they're coming to us and talking about how they intend to deal with the budget, essentially, which is why we want to give you guys good information before Mr. Ferguson Pell comes in, Dr. Ferguson Pell comes in next council meeting. So as I mentioned, the CPI cap, the maximum regular tuition increases or increases boards may pursue limited to the rate of inflation. It's calculated as an average of the annual change in the consumer price index, and in practice, our board always pursues the maximum increase. So they don't have to charge CPI if they don't want to. They could not raise our tuition by anything. They're only allowed to raise up to CPI, and they have done that every single year since 2009 when the cap went in place, to obviously continue raising their expenditure portfolio so that more money can be spent. I think this is you, but I can touch on it really quick. This is not regulated. International tuition does not fall under any regulations whatsoever.
Yeah, sure. So, like Adam said, international student tuition is not regulated. Why is that? The rational philosophy behind this is that, well, Albertan Canadian taxpayers, they pay for their education to be rather affordable, to be approximately $5,000, $6,000. Whereas international students, their parents didn't pay, or they didn't pay the taxes to make education as affordable as it actually is. So that's kind of the philosophy that they pose, that others may pose when talking about international students and tuition. Now, there are some problems with that, but when we look at international student tuition, they pay exponentially higher tuition rates, and it's quite worrisome. And increasingly, they're being seen as kind of a cash cow in terms of like how much they can give back to the institution. And a general trend within higher education, not only in Canada but within the States, is to actually increase the amount of international student enrollment you have. So you can kind of double up with how much money you get. So let's say, you have 100 students at your university, and the government, let's say, gives you $100, right? So that's $1 per student you have. If you have an international student and they pay more, you're getting the same amount from the provincial government, but you're also having the added bonus of them paying higher tuition, right? So we're seeing, if we look at institutions like the U of C, for instance, they made it very clear that they're not going to be accepting more domestic students this year compared to last year, but they're trying to really, really bump up their international student enrollment to have that increase in revenues. And it's really worrisome to see international students have really large, unregulated tuition rates, especially since a large amount of them want to, let's say, make Canada their home, or they want to become permanent residences and start paying Alberta and Canadian taxes. So that's really an unfortunate effect, and we are seeing a lot of negative side effects of, let's say, increased strain on international students, from mental health to financial strains. And that's a large issue that we want to kind of focus on this year. We recently did get that letter from the university saying that they are looking at increasing international student tuition. So we're kind of concerned about that, especially with the provincial government very clearly stating tuition shouldn't go up. They didn't specify domestic or international. They just made that statement. So we're going to keep our eye posted on that. But that's really something important to look at. At University of Lethbridge, they said that they're going to increase their international student international differential fee. And I think it's a ratio of something like 2.6 or something like that. And they at the University of Lethbridge, they increased it to 3 point something. So I'm not entirely sure how much of a cost increase that directly translates into. And when it comes to mandatory non-instructional fees, I think they increased their mandatory non-instructional fees by something like 300% to the University of Lethbridge as well. So it's pretty scary to see it happen to another larger institution within Alberta, and seeing if the U of A is trying to, you know, copy some of the same methods that they did in order to deal with the budget.
If I may add, here's one thing that I think you're trying to get at is we see our institutions trying to take advantage of what I would call, in a lot of senses, cash cows. So obviously we want international students at the U of A. It's a great thing that we have them. But with that being said, we want to be bringing them over for the right reasons. We don't want them here for the money. We want them here because we want to give them a good education and allow them to go whatever way they want afterwards. We're not just bringing them in for the point of bringing in more money. And that's why you might see the universities increasing the number of international students they want in the school around these tough times. It also might be the reason that they're taking less domestic students at this time. And furthermore to that, I mean, obviously, that also relates to fees and tuition. The more students they bring in with higher fees, the more money they're going to be getting.
Is the next slide one.
So another thing that we're going to touch on briefly is another way that they'll try to bring in money is through what's called market modifiers. So this market modifiers, I'll explain what they are first. So at the end of the day, some would argue that every degree is worth kind of a different amount, and based on a fair market value, the university claims that they can essentially change the price of certain degrees as compared to others because they're more valuable at a market rate. I don't want to go all the way back. If we went back to the chart earlier that outlined tuition, especially by individual faculty, you'll notice, for example, that pharmacy was like way up there. That is because at this time a pharmacy degree is deemed to be more valuable than, say, an arts degree, and therefore they can throw in a market modifier which modifies the price of that degree to a more marketly appropriable price, and they can charge a higher tuition. So I think pharmacy students are, what are pharmacy students paying right now? Like
10?
10, 11, yeah. So this is up to total ministerial discretion. The minister makes a final call on this. There is a criteria for approval and timelines, but with that being said, at the end of the day, it comes down to what the minister feels is appropriate for each institution. And that, another thing to keep in mind and bear witness to, because they are dealing with, I mean, the university, I mean, many universities across the province are likely going to run a deficit this year. So it's a matter of watching out for these things. And again, we look back at average tuition. This was in 2011 and 2012, and I should add that the Center for Policy Alternatives, which is a Canadian-based research firm in Ottawa, they estimate that by the 2015 year, we will have the third highest tuition in Canada, which we're already up there, but we are going to have higher rates than actually, I think it had Ontario. I'm going to have to find that source. But they do predict our tuition going up substantially. So, I guess what I'm trying to say here is that the trend over the past few years has very generally been that Alberta's tuition as a whole compared to all the other provinces has been skyrocketing. And it relates back, we talked about it earlier, to increased expenditures in the consolidated budget and trying to find more ways to pay for it, especially now that we've seen this cut, how are they going to pay for it is really what it comes down to. So, again, we've seen massive increases since 1999 throughout Canada. Alberta has seen the highest percentage increases since 1990. We've seen a 327% increase in Ontario universities, but you saw Ontario was one of the highest ones up there. We've seen 357% increase in Alberta. So CPI for the same period increased by 55%. So far our tuition has gone over 300% over CPI since 1990, which is, again, showing that the university likes to spend more without necessarily making more, and then they do it through students.
Another point that I just wanted to raise is in the early 90s, our tuition used to be very comparable to Quebec, actually. Which is rather interesting. So it's just kind of interesting to see the trends that's happening.
Quebec and Newfoundland have the two, and Manitoba, they are the three provinces with the lowest tuition rates in the country, and we used to be like that, now we're not. So, just some more numbers. So, the national average of a mandatory non-instructional fee, this is now fees, $750. And we look at places like Ontario, where in order for those fees to even be approved, you have to get that student's union to sign off. The student's union has to sign a piece of paper saying, yes, we approve this fee, it's good. Which, I believe, in our case, that would happen with a lot of fees, athletics and rec fee. I will pay, I think it's $60 a semester for gym membership. I will pay another, I think it's around $50 for healthcare and services on campus. We look at the U of A, though, our student-approved fee, we have just over $1,000 in compulsory fees. $335 of it is student-approved, so we're talking UPass, we're talking health and dental plan, we're talking student union proposed fees, and then we look at university's fees. So we pay around $737 in unapproved mandatory fees. That's every one of you, and you add it all up when you look at all the students, that is a quite the pot of money, and that is how they attempt to finance a lot of things. In a lot of cases, the money does go where it's supposed to go. But we look at things like the cause fee right here. So this is, you guys will hear us harp on it all year. I brought up earlier fees like athletics and rec, health and dental, other university, like university fees. So I'm trying to think of some other mandatory university fees. Health and these things are charged by the university, but you could justify them. You could say that these things actually have a use on our campus. The cause fee, however, is something that we don't even know really what it pays for. There's an unclear reporting of where the money is going. We've heard rumors from far and wide as to things that it pays for. We look at things like graduate student research. So we actually, as undergraduates, help fund graduate student research. We, as undergraduate, we don't know for sure, but we believe that we help pay for the nuclear waste removal. Like, just things that really have no relevance to us being here whatsoever. This is just their means of saying, okay, well, our expenditures are a bit higher than our revenue this year, so why don't we just go ahead and jack these up a bit? And, again, it's a problem. So, impact of fees on students, increased work during school, increased student debt, increased use of food banks, one thing we've noticed, increased levels of stress, obviously. The less money you have, the more stressed you're going to be. Especially when it comes down to university, you're trying to afford and earn your own education. The more and more fees go up, the less and less that's attainable, and it is a problem.
So the other part that I wanted to highlight a little bit, at least within this presentation, is talking about the quality of education. So, I mean, while it's important, we talk about the costs, et cetera, I think that talking about the actual quality of education is really important. So that, you know, some, the way that others may see this is, why are we paying more for less? So when we look at, let's say, our tuition rates since the 1990s, increasing by over 300% after inflation, what's a good way to measure, you know, the increase in quality of education that we've had since then? So the indicator that most institutions use in determining the quality of education that one has is kind of the student-to-faculty ratio. So that's saying, you know, how much faculty do you have for every student. And normally, in the early 90s, we were looking at 19. So for every 19 professors or academic staff that we had, for every 19 students that we had, there's one academic staff, right? Why is that important? That means, you know, if there's less students in your class, you're able to engage more with your professors or your instructors. You're able to talk to them after hours. You're able to develop that relationship. Whereas, you know, I imagine with most of you folks have experienced, if you're in a large classroom, it's really hard to get that engagement, it's really hard to get that really strong educational background. My best experiences were my third and fourth year courses when it's smaller, and it's really important in terms of, like, you know, we're paying a lot more, are we having that better quality of education? And when we look at the student to teaching faculty ratio now, it's something like floating around 23 to 1, right? So we went from like around 19 to 1 and 23 to 1 in over just two decades, right? So it's actually gotten worse, right? We're having less academic staff per student on our campus, despite this large increase in, let's say, how much we are contributing to our institution through, let's say, tuition and fees. So that's kind of a concern that we have as well. And there's a growing trend in, you know, our full-time professors, the ones who, let's say, get paid the most, they have two duties, right, just like the institution does. They have the research side of it, making sure that they're publishing, the whole publish or perish, stream of thought. There's also the teaching. Now, for the professors, it's one of the trends that we're finding is it's harder for students to get increased access to them. Like Dustin mentioned, we have over 40% of our courses being taught, let's say, by contracted instructors of which a lot of the time don't have steady employment. Pay is rather sporadic. It's rather difficult. And they're the ones who are, for the most part, teaching undergraduates, right? So where's kind of the money going? Where's some of the priorities? There's some questions that we need to be thinking about. Some have proposed the idea of having teaching tenure, right? So what's tenure? If you're teaching at an institution for long enough, you have your job secured. So as a result, you can focus more on, let's say, research, and you can balance it out with one class. But with that, we're finding, again, a lot of professors focusing on research. Institutions around the world are proposing something called teaching tenures, where you have full-time professors actually focus on teaching. So teaching is kind of a priority for them. Some of these ideas have been floating around at this institution as a result of these budget cuts, and it would be really interesting to follow up with the acting provost saying, you know, what are we doing to really ensure the quality of our education here? Are we relying, like, what steps or what revolutionary ideas are being proposed to make sure that, you know, these academic superstars that we're paying for are actually given the opportunity to teach us, right? And that class sizes don't balloon. So that's something really interesting to look out for. Yes. And with that being said, that's pretty much it. If we look at the Dare to Discover report card, so the institution outlined a lot of its plans a number of years ago, saying, you know, what do we want to become in a number of years, in a report called, you know, Dare to Discover. And then as a result, they made something called Dare to Deliver. So that's their plan of executing this. And when they looked at the report card a while back, you know, even though, you know, the case will often be made, like, we have the lowest per student funding from the government, or it's dropped quite drastically. If we take into account tuition and fees and funding from the provincial governments, we actually have some of the highest per student funding, right? So that's when you look into how much students pay for fees, and then look at how much the government gives. You do the simple arithmetic, and the amount of money the university gets per student is actually quite high. So that's kind of a
23,000 and change.
So in other words, that means that while that money might be looked at it on the first person who pays it, it's not necessarily going towards students. There's only one university in the country that has a higher per student rating than us, and that's the University of Toronto. With the University of Toronto,
which is ridiculous, is what it comes at.
So, Dustin will kind of cover some of this.
So, I can see that most of you are super bored. If you want to take out a pen and paper, now is probably the time. You've got an hour with the provost in the next council meeting to just dump questions. What's happening to the budget? We're seeing the biggest budget cuts in the past 20 years. And what we've tried to do is give you the context so that you can use language that the provost will understand, words like operating budget, per student funding, faculty to student ratios, so that you don't get condescended to and so that you can have a real legitimate conversation about where this university is going in the next few years. What do we know already? For 2013-2014 budget, they have a $43 million reduction in expected revenues from the deduction of the Campus Alberta grant, 4% expected increase in both salaries, benefits, and merit increments. They're carrying a deficit for four full years, and I'll touch on that in a minute. That hasn't yet been approved by government, from my understanding. And a four-year deficit is really quite substantial. In particular, if you compare that to University of Calgary, who's carrying a surplus this year, and the University of Lethbridge, that carried about a $2 million deficit this year. The University of Alberta is recording about a $42-43 million deficit this year. So, interesting to compare how the U of A is performing against some of our Alberta peers. The biggest cut that you're seeing this year is $2.4 million to scholarships, with $9.2 million cut overall. That's from other lines, utilities, supplies, sundries, etc. But biggest chunk is $2.4 million cut to scholarships this year. What's interesting to note are things that aren't on here. One of the things that I didn't talk about earlier when I was talking about expenditure, flexibility around salaries, two things. I'll let Petros talk about one of them. But there is one way that you can start to reduce the cost of academic staff. Non-academic staff aren't under a tenure system, and so they are, in a sense, and I hate to say this because these are people's jobs, people's lives, but they're easier to let go than academic staff are. And so what you've seen is over the past about 4 years, non-academic staff have really been hit hard. You have less advisors, less janitorial staff, less student services staff, less people without PhDs serving students, fewer attempts, etc. They're really, really suffering and taking on large workloads because so many of their colleagues have been cut. You don't see academic staff being cut. One of the ways that academic staff can be shuffled around or lose their positions, and again, I hate to talk about this because these are people's jobs, people's parents, but it's something under the collective agreement called an Article 32 or an Article 33. Article 32 is called academic reorganization, where you need professors out of their departments to a different department. And this happened back in the 1990s, for example, where professors moved out of the Department of Classics, or the Department of, I think it was like Greek Studies, into the Department of History and Classics, reduced teaching loads, and eventually some professors were laid off. And Article 33 is something called a financial exigency, where the university essentially publicly declares, look, we're going bankrupt, we have no choice but to lay professors off. Neither of these are being considered by the university now or in the future, according to the provost. That's what we've heard. Second thing that you don't see in here is a decrease or a 0% increase in salaries and benefits. And I don't know if Petros wants to talk a little bit about what the government said.
So, Minister Lukasik sent a letter to the different board chairs at all the different post-secondary education institutions in the province saying, hey, I'd like you folks to reduce academic salaries from having it to 0% increases this year, next year having it at 0%, the year after having a 0% increase, and then Dustin and I were debating whether it was a 2 or 4% increase, 2% increase the year after. So now, with that being said, it's a lot harder to, you know, the university has contractual agreements with Academic Staff Association, and to all of a sudden just kind of say, well, you know what, we got a letter from the minister, we're going to ban it. It's a little bit tougher than that. But that is kind of the demands that's being put on by the provincial government to the institutions of saying, hey, we want you to reduce your academic salaries. And that's, and again, like we brought up earlier in the operating budget, that's the primary, you know, that's the primary expenses of plus 75% or so. And that's kind of the demands that the ministers are going in. I don't know if some of you folks heard about what happened with Alberta Health Services a couple weeks ago. So Alberta Health Services, their board was planning of giving like salary increases or bonuses to like 99 executives or whatever it was. The minister said, hey, don't give increases. The board chair said, no, we promised it. And the board chair didn't, and everyone on the board got fired. So there's a real fear that it's from some individuals that like, you know, how much, what are some of the repercussions for, let's say, not obeying the minister, and what those repercussions can essentially mean for the university budget going on in the future, right? So yeah, that's something really interesting to keep in mind. That, but yeah, I think we're pretty much done the presentation. Sorry. Let's see. Yeah, and these are just some of the plans moving forward.
Yeah, I'll be really brief. So this is the plan of the next 3 more years. $26 million cut in 2014-15, an additional $30 million cut in 15-16, so that actually adds up to a $56 million cut. Add that to another $17 million cut in 16-17, that means 3 academic years from now, the university will be working on about $82 million less. I don't have the operating budget. Gateway's here, so I probably shouldn't say this, but whatever. $82 million is approximately the operating budget of some of our largest faculties, arts, for example. It's a big reduction. So how are decisions going to be made? Decisions on what are called base cuts. These are all base operating cuts. It's coming from money that the university needs every single year to operate. Those base decisions are going to be made on budgetary principles and measures. Currently, the provost's office has a set of 5 measures that it uses to determine faculty excellence, things like student retention, faculty to student ratios, H-index scores, which is a measure of research output for faculty members. They're going to accept two more measures submitted by deans. Based on those combined seven measures of excellence, every faculty for next year will be given a 5% cut to their operating budget, plus or minus 2%. So some faculties could be cut 7%, some could be cut 3%, based on their measure of excellence. How that process will look, not entirely sure. Back in 1990, when the university was experiencing similar cuts, there was a report that was made public to the university community that said, look, based on some of the data that we have, this is our recommendation for 5, either closures or amalgamations. The university had some really confidential conversations on where vertical versus where like vertical operating cuts should be made, which faculty should be cut more than others. Those conversations were confidential, and then the university produced a really, I think, strong final report summarizing how it got to these decisions back in 1991. We've yet to see any sort of understanding of an open, democratic, collegial process where students will have a voice in how cuts will be made. We don't have an awareness of the 5 measures or the 2 additional measures on which budgetary cut decisions will be made. We don't have any indication of what the timeline will look like for making any of these 3 rounds of cuts. And all we heard recently, and I don't know, I'm thanking the Gateway for this, is apparently Indira is sending out a document called her Change Agenda. Don't know when it's happening. Maybe Gateway or Petros can fill us in. Sending out a change agenda document where she outlines how she would like to see these cuts made. So that's the information that I have.
And surrounding the change agenda, I did talk about it a little bit in my report, actually. It's in the first page. It's the 3rd paragraph. So it's essentially talking about how the university is going to be dealing with the budgetary pressures. It's talking about human resources, Campus Alberta initiatives, so how the university is going to be working with other institutions in the province. And the board chair called it the most important thing we'll be doing over the next couple of years. So it should be lots of fun. So I'll be sure to keep you folks posted on that. But that's pretty much it. I guess like some questions to think about for the acting provost is like, what's going to be a part of this change agenda, right? What are some of the aspects of it? How is it going to be developed? And will there be any sense of consultation, let's say, perhaps? What are some of these budgetary principles and measures that you're planning on using in determining which faculties are going to get X amount of cuts, right? So is it going to be a 3% cut or a 7% cut? Other questions that you could that could be asked is like, how do we ensure teaching excellence over the number of years? What revolutionary ideas are being proposed? Are we talking about teaching tenures? Are we talking about tri-semesters? So that's having 3 semesters in 1 year, right? I mean, there's a lot of really interesting ideas that this, at the board level, we've kind of flirted with at our board retreats in April. But are any of these revolutionary ideas actually going to be taking place, right? And I think, how are we going to manage some of these cost pressures, let's say academic salaries and other issues? So those are some questions that you folks can start brewing. If you have any questions ahead of, that we can ask the provost ahead of time, so you don't have to get an answer being like, I'll get back at you, that'd be excellent. And I can forward it on to the active provost.
And one thing I'd like to emphasize is that this, like, be very respectful of Dr. Kirk. He's a doctor. He's also a lovely man. And that being said, this is the meeting to ask as many questions as humanly possible, because they hear it from myself, Petros, and Dustin all the time. But to have a whole different room of people asking hopefully very similar questions to what we've been asking to reinforce the legitimacy of them is really a phenomenal thing for us, and it really shows that this isn't just what we've been saying for the last how many months. This is what students think, and these are student issues, and you need to address them rather than just, yeah, I'll get back to you. So
that's it for our presentation. Thanks so much for being very patient, and I guess, and I can see a couple of you guys really struggling. It's okay. But really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. We currently, in this segment, have 2 minutes left for questions. I'll look for questions unless one of you guys is going to make a motion to extend.
Well, I think some folks had their hands way earlier that this year.
I'm not sure.
Are you sure? Okay.
Feel free to direct.
Yeah, is this going to be
online? You know what? We wanted to actually make a really nice, like, 2-page summary of it. It was kind of hard. Adam and I came back from Lethbridge recently, so it was kind of a headache. We'll be sure to send it to you folks. I'll try to see if I can even add additional notes or even send out extra reports for you folks to check out as well. So that'd be excellent. Yeah, I'll be for sure sending it out. And then also, all the PowerPoints are posted online.
There is a, in case you're not familiar, any presentations that we get a copy of, sort of centrally, myself and Nicole, there's a section on the council's website called presentations that we get.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Is the COSI part of the operating budget?
Sorry, it's a what?
COSI part of the operating budget.
Oh, okay.
Yes. It's just kind of bizarre because I, as far as I know, the only thing I know about it is like it's they in the description the fees for like the maintenance of hallways.
They change the description every like 2 to 3 months. The last time we complained about the description, they just changed it.
That's an easy solution.
President Kuzumi, you talked about like how the money for research, like the research budget and the operating budget, are two different things, and costs are paid from the operating budget, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And then Vice President Chellen, you said that tenured profs, they do 40-40-20, so 40% teaching, 40% research, and 20% service. Is that in accordance with how they're paid? Like 40% comes out of the operating budget, 40% comes out of the research budget, or does it all come out of the
It all comes out of the operating budget. Academic staff salaries that aren't used, so those that are professors that are tenured, 40-40-20, all comes out of the operating budget. Lab assistants, research assistants will come out of primarily the research budget. The research budget is can be used for professor salaries just as a top up. So, for example, professors will get principal investigatorship on grants, and that will add to their salary, or that will give them funding that they can use to distribute to hire research assistants, equipment, travel, etc., as part of their research mission. So, the 40-40-20 pay increments do come from the operating budget. In other words, they are funded by student tuition and fees.
So we are at our time limit unless anyone wishes to make a motion to extend.
Maybe just one more question.
We have two more questions. Can I make a motion to extend presentation by 2 minutes?
Suspend standing orders to extend for another 15 minutes. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Vice President Chellen requires a 2/3 majority. All those in favor of suspending standing orders? Any opposed? Okay, so we're going to go 18.
Just a point to add to that. Something that's really important to keep in mind is something called the indirect costs of research. So, the counter argument that may be raised is, well, you know what, we get top ups from research funding and et cetera. But there are a lot of indirect costs related to research that research fundings aren't being provided. So, for instance, if a professor gets a research grant, there's a lot more strain on that professor to be doing, let's say, research, and that passes on to, let's say, administrative assistants within that faculty and within that department. And as a result, there's kind of like, you know, sure, they got cash to do research, but there's a lot of indirect costs that's kind of being added up as a result of them doing more research. Now, grants, federally, provincially, when they give, let's say, $100 to the professor to research, they usually give something like 7% or I want to say 20% extra to cover, and 27% extra to cover, let's say, the indirect costs related to research. But a big strain is that there's not enough of that actually, and that's being taken out of, let's say, that's really negatively impacting students because students are paying more for that indirect cost related to research. And there's a potential for actually updating our political policies to reflect that, or I think we already do have it in our political policies. Anyways, that's just a little tip that I wanted to add.
Sorry, I do have one more question.
I would encourage you to take one question from each person. I'll let you direct, but I would encourage you to take the first question from everyone and then go back to the second question.
Okay.
Then.
Sure. Do you just want to add a few?
Sure. Maybe that's easier. I don't know who else had their hand up. Councillor Patel? Go ahead.
I just wanted to know what your guys' position on this. Did you set certain criteria that you want to address? Like, are you worried mostly about increasing student tuition, or are you worried about the quality of the education or the student professor ratio? Like, what's your main concern if it comes down to it?
As you ask.
When we heard about the budget, that's we spent whole Saturday and Sunday hanging out in the office. Petros and I, back when Petros was working as Vice President of External, and I think, and I know it sounds silly, but the thing we came up with is we want to minimize harm to students, be that financial harm
quality of instruction. And I don't think it's a trade-off. My perspective is I think that there are other ways that this so-called budget crisis can be dealt with that doesn't harm students substantially, or that minimizes harm for students when you take a look at. And this is my personal perspective, not that of Students Council. When you take a look at staff salaries, staff benefit packages increasing even at a higher rate than inflation. Don't know if that is necessarily in the best interest of the institution, but certainly not in the best interest of students if that will result in quality cuts. But I do have to say those because it's run by a sea political policy. I think one of the most obvious important things that we don't want to see happen is tuition or fee increases. It's something that SU political policy says no, absolutely not, we will not support.
Yeah, so like I would almost argue that we're at a crossroads here. I like his point there about you look at administrative pay as well as professor pay, and you look at how it increases by pretty well 2% every year. Well, we're not always guaranteed the same base operating grant adjustment that we get every single year. All the while fees have been going up as well as tuition. All the while our size of classrooms is going up and our faculty to student ratio is going down. We're seeing, as was mentioned like several times, we're seeing a much less quality education for a much higher price, all the while everybody else is getting paid more. This is really a point where we need to, I would argue, almost say stop. Let's take another look at things. And I would say this is a great thing about PSLA opening up later, is it gives us the opportunity to hopefully make some of the changes that we think should happen in Alberta post-secondary.
And another really, really quick thing to add as well is normally, like, let's say faculty associations or even us as students union, we're kind of given like, hey, you know, you got to increase one, or you got to increase tuition or fees, or you got to, you know, pick programming, the student faculty ratio, like which one is it going to be? For us, we feel like that's an unfair question. Normally, we're not privy to a lot of the, you know, a greater understanding of the budget, and normally it's kind of, when we do ask a lot of questions, it's kind of like, you know, pulling teeth, right? For instance, like Dustin reported, mentioned earlier, that a lot of the reporting with the university's financials and larger statistics has stopped being published since like 2010 online. And we're saying, hey, we're trying to get a better understanding of the budget, we're trying to get a better understanding of some of the pressures you folks are dealing with, but it's not helping when you're restricting some of this information. So we're having that conversation about the dean's letters quite a couple of council meetings ago, where the point that we're trying to make is help us have a better understanding of the budget and the scenarios that you're going with, so we can really have a more informed decision and statements when we get these kind of questions. So,
all the while they're making less information available.
Thank you. In the interest of time, and given that we do have other presentations and motions, I would encourage really quick questions and answers. Councillor Speakman?
Why or how are scholarships more fluid, and if they get cut, like, I don't understand where that money would go if it was cut.
It's more fluid because it isn't bound to agreements. So staff, you have a staff member that will be coming back next year that you must have to pay. With scholarship dollars, the university has some discretion over how it wants to award them. Some scholarships are granted by donors, so when I get old, I'll donate and say that $1,000 a year should go to a math student. That money is required to be given to a math student every year because I said so. That was part of my request as a donation. But the university also spends funds through their operating budget to attract students here. First year entrance scholarships are a prime example, saying, hey, come here, they'll cost $1,000 less for you if you got this great scholarship. That money is more fluid because it isn't bound up, it isn't committed to next year's students yet. The university had time to adjust their scholarship offers after the March announcement. Didn't offer scholarships, and so we'll be offering about $2 million less in scholarships this year. Meanwhile, the government of Alberta also increased their amount towards a student aid.
But the point with that is that's normally the argument that, and I hate to extend this answer, but so in 2009, the provincial government cut $90 million to non-refundable student aid. But with that being said, when you look at, you know, the university would be like, look, the government's giving more money for students. Hey, that's BS. That's not fair. When you look at it, it's actually increasing the amount of loans that's giving out to students. And there, some of the cash that they used to give out to students for student loan relief. So if you have way too much loans, it'll like help you get off, like relieve it. They've actually put some of the money to non-targeted student aid. So saying like, oh, if you graduate and you have a student loan, you'll get $2,500. Even if you have a $300 student loan or a $30,000 student loan, right? So they've actually, in our opinion, they haven't been really wise with their investments when it comes to student aid, and actually they've been increasing the amount of loans.
So they're not necessarily making the situation better for students, and that's a really important counter argument you need to raise when individuals raise that.
To make it like a little bit more like, so they're giving the scholarship, they're giving aid money to people, like, for example, just example, like, say Max gets a 4.0, but William has the money to pay for school. They would, at this time, they're giving more money to Max or his 4.0 than William is getting because his family and he don't have any money. Just an example, not saying that's actually the case, but yeah.
Thank you. Councillor Hamill?
I just had a question for you, Vice President John. So they got cut $43 million, but then when you look at, like, the debt actually right there, cutting expenditures by $82 million, like, where's that $40 million? Like, why are they cutting that extra? So do they actually do that?
Yeah, that's actually a fantastic question. I wish I had the CIP in front of me right away. I think part of it is to reduce the deficit. So it's, this year they're carrying a $43 million deficit. This year they've got a $43 million deficit. Next year they're predicting a 0% increase with staff benefits increasing by about 4%. That and wanting to decrease the deficit to about, I think, $20 million next year. So you've got about $20 million... You've got the previous however many million dollars, I don't know how much is being cut from 13-14. You've got the previous cut added to a deficit for increase in salaries and benefits, added to wanting to cut the deficit yields that, like, increasing amount of cut, which is $82 million. If I were Phyllis Clark and had a PhD in economics, I'd be able to explain this to you better.
Petra's really important point to take in mind is, before these budget cuts even happened, the university had a deficit.
Yeah.
Their deficit was around $15 million, $20 million-ish. That's a good point to ask, or if you want me to send it to the back of Provost at a time, that'd be fantastic so you can get you those numbers. But that's really important in mind. We already had a deficit before these budget cuts, and this is adding on top of it. So,
thank you. Question via Skype from Councillor Chivone. Could we try to use the Freedom of Information Act in Alberta to request the budget information that we lack to help us make better decisions, or do universities not fall under the public sphere of that act?
I have done so, and I received all the budget letters today. No, a lot of the information was redacted, so I have some information particularly on the international differential fee, but I don't have the specific faculty so I am submitting a request for review, and hopefully I will get those.
I also just deferred my speaking turn to Michelle Merck, who is the news editor for the
And if you wouldn't mind, just come sign in after. I'd just like to have a written record of everyone that speaks in the meeting. So at some point, that would be great. I'm not sure if you caught all of that on Skype, but if not, I'm sure the execs can fill you in on that information afterwards. I don't want to take up too much more time here. Vice President Lau.
Could I ask a quick question to counsel? Just really quickly, like, if we needed Google Docs for everyone to kind of, like, post up questions and just kind of bounce ideas off each other, would that help?
Well, that's a question to these guys. You can answer if you want.
Yes, it would help.
Continue on. Councilor Menarcy.
I yield my question time. I'm not going to ask it.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, what is your name?
My name's Chris. I've been medical student.
Oh, yes, Chris.
I'm planning on this one.
Motion. Okay, so he's a guest. We've invited guests to FAs. You want to make a motion to suspend standing orders so they can talk?
Motion to suspend standing orders to let guests to council speak.
Second. Seconded by Governor Kelly. All those in favor of standing orders? Do you guys know what's going on Skype? So we have guests. Oh! What? Oh, did I say Governor Kelly?
Yeah, I'm not
I'm
Governor
sorry.
Kelly.
Vice President Woods.
I look like Governor Kelly, I know.
Sorry about that. Okay. Sorry about that. Vice President Woods. Seconded. All those in favor?
Yeah.
Any opposed? Okay. That motion is... Okay, that motion carries. So go ahead. Sorry about that.
Sorry, I didn't realize that'd be so difficult. But this is a question like specific to medicine. Are teachers paid through academic ARPs, alternative relationship funds? There's been a lot of changes with that. And have you guys been following?
I haven't been following the changes to ARPs. FOMD staff, though, are paid through operating budget funding. Yeah.
Okay, it is through operating budget?
Yep, my understanding. Oh, you know what? I'm not familiar with the interplay between AHS funding and operating budget.
we pull up on that?
Yeah, let's get together.
Yeah, there's a lot of like rumblings about it. So.
And again, just if you wouldn't mind at some point coming in and signing my guest list, we can make sure that you're listed on the guest. We have 2 minutes left if anyone else has questions. Councilor Greenham?
How are market modifiers going to be affected in different capacities?
We don't know, to be honest. Like that is a very good question. We don't know if they're going to make any proposals. In my guess, I would say they probably would. You're going to see faculties again, like pharmacy, probably medicine, perhaps, like put on science. But some of the more specialized faculties, like I assume law, will probably see a market modifier.
Yeah, we've heard indications from pharmacy and law that they are interested in a market modifier. Discussions coming from other professional faculties, business and medicine. Science is thinking about proposing a fee for lab courses in the lab. With any market modifier fees, the university has an internal template that requires decision makers to consult with their faculty association. That's why we brought faculty associations here. Adam Petros and I probably won't hear about market modifiers before a faculty association does.
And we probably won't hear about them until they're like decided upon either.
Correct. And there's rumors of graduate tuition increasing by $10,000. So. Okay. With that, we are out of time. If you have any further questions, I would encourage you, I'm sure any of the executives would be happy to discuss anything with you offline to inform you of anything you might have questions for. So thank you for the presentation. Okay, with that, we're moving on. Item 2B, creating a safe space for folks. Again, if you're going to move around, just do it really quietly, please. Creating a safe space for Mr. Omar Ahmed Khadr to receive an education, sponsored by Councillor Mohammed, seconded by Governor Kelly. Is there any objection to hearing this presentation? Seeing none, we will proceed. Councillor Mohammed, the floor is yours. Yeah, you're welcome to set up here. And while Councillor Mohammed's setting up, perhaps I'll clarify to Council, in case any of you are curious, we haven't had a meeting this long yet, but standing orders say that we take a recess after the first actual order of business, after it's been at least 90 minutes. So it's certainly been at least 90 minutes, but we haven't hit any orders of business yet. So that's why we haven't yet taken a recess. I would encourage not all of you guys to run away, because I don't want to lose quorum. Or at least run away staggered so that we don't lose quorum. I'll give Councilor Mohammed a couple minutes to set up here. Sorry, we still have everyone on Skype. So we do still have quorum on Skype. Oh.
I love being
here. Councillor Schiavone, go ahead with your point of parliamentary inquiry.
Please suspend the orders to reset now or no?
You could. In fact, it wouldn't even require a suspension of standing orders. You can make a motion to recess at any point throughout a meeting.
Can I make that motion?
Do you want to make that motion? Okay, let me just double check that we still have quorum here. There are 4 of you still online. 18, so we just have 4. If you guys would mind just hanging out. Yeah, you can go to the table. Okay, so Councillor Schiavone is making a motion to adjourn now. Or, sorry, not adjourn, to recess now. To have a 15-minute recess now. Do we have a seconder for a motion to recess? Councillor Valdez, thank you. So again, this motion isn't debatable and isn't amendable. Let me just double-check if it requires a 2/3 majority. I don't believe it does. Excuse me, it is amendable, but it's not debatable. So, all those in favor of adjourning for 15 minutes, please raise your placard.
Recess,
thank you.
9.
All opposed. Okay, that motion carries. So, we are recessed until 8:36. Thank you. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to call this back to order, so if you wouldn't mind grabbing your seats. We still have a number of items on the agenda. So for those of you that weren't here when we started our recess, I started by saying a recess was called, there was a motion to recess beforehand, so that's why we recessed when we did. But otherwise, if no motion to recess is called beforehand, we automatically recess after the first order of business is dealt with once we're 90 minutes in. So we just hadn't gotten to an order of business yet, which is why we hadn't recessed. But again, we are going to begin the presentation by Councillor Mohammed, so you have 30 minutes.
Hello, everyone. So to start out, I gave everyone a booklet. Now, this booklet's dated. It was actually printed last year. What happened since then was that in September, Omar Khadr was actually repatriated back to Canada, and he was brought to Edmonton in May. And then also, if you look at the page with all the people, it says that that guy is his lawyer, but his lawyer currently is Dennis Edney. He used to be his military lawyer during the tribunals. So just... I guess I'll just jump right into it. Where's the mouse?
Oh, sorry. That's okay. The mouse is down here. Yeah. You're welcome to pull it out.
Oh, thank you. So, who is Omar Khadr? So, he was born September 19, 1986, in Toronto, Canada. He's a Canadian citizen, and he moved to Jalalabad, Afghanistan at age 10. During that period of time, he moved back and forth between Afghanistan because his father was in the relief business. His father also knew Osama bin Laden, so that's also a point of contention. Sorry, my phone's being silly. But on July 27, 2002, he was wounded by the American military. I don't get too much into this, but it's covered in the booklet, or you can just Wikipedia it. But essentially, the U.S. military, this was right after 9/11, so the U.S. military was suspicious of the compound. So they bombed it for 4 hours, and then they sent in a special forces team, and a U.S. soldier was killed, and they blamed that death on Omar Khadr. So what is he not? Sorry for the graphic photo, but he's not a convicted criminal, he's not a terrorist. Now, the other side of this argument uses that photo against Omar, and they say that this is a photo of Omar holding severed hands. This photo is actually fake. It's not a real photo. And here's a statement from his military lawyer. I have never seen or heard anything like this. I can assure you that if such a video existed, the U.S. government would have used it in their case. So there's a lot of misinformation in this case, and it's a huge point of contention. So, if we just tear away everything and just move back to the point that he was 15 when this happened, you can see that he's a child soldier. Because if we start trying child soldiers, then what are we going to do? Are we going to try all the child soldiers that fought in the conflict in Rwanda, for example? You know, it doesn't set a good precedence. So what is he? He's a former child soldier, according to the UN. In the booklet, you can see that he was officially declared as child soldier in 2010. And he's the first child to be condemned for war crimes since the concept was defined in the Nuremberg trials after World War II. And he's also the youngest person detained in Guantanamo Bay. And he was the last Western citizen to be detained in Gitmo. And he's also just a kid. Actually, when he was captured, he was flown to Bagram. And at Bagram Air Base, he was tortured. And then he was tortured again in Guantanamo. This is actually one of the interrogators, and this is a quote about Omar. He says, "All I can say about him is that he was a kid, a typical 15-year-old kid. The child was still in there, and that's what was prevalent in him, was a child." He actually commented that during court hearings, he'd be reading comic books. In 2002, the Canadian government sent officials to go interrogate him. But they weren't like diplomatic officials. They were CSIS, and CSIS is the spy agency. In 2008, the Supreme Court ruled that the government acted illegally by sending the agents there, and they ordered the video to be released. If you're interested, on the back of this, it talks about a documentary called "You Don't Like the Truth," and it essentially goes over the footage. And it's really traumatic what the Canadian officials did to him. And he actually went 2 years without legal counsel. So where is he now? He's in Edmonton. This is the new remand center outside of Edmonton. He was originally, when he was repatriated, moved to a prison in Ontario, but he was assaulted, so they moved him to Edmonton. He was actually assaulted a few weeks ago. However, he's going to be in Edmonton for the long haul. They don't want to go through the hassle of moving him back and forth. And he's awaiting his parole hearing. His parole hearing should happen. Oh, I didn't mention, in 2010... he took a plea bargain on the trial, and they sentenced him to 8 years. If he didn't take the plea bargain, it would have been 40 years. And this is a really weird situation because He's guilty under the Guantanamo Bay military tribunals. That's not U.S. law. That's not Canadian law. That's not even U.S. military law. It's people consider a kangaroo court, and the U.S. doesn't recognize it. So he's in this weird situation where he's serving not even U.S. law, but he's serving a military, the Guantanamo Bay military tribunal decision in Canada. When he came back to Canada, we thought he'd have a retrial, but I guess it didn't happen. So he's 26 years old now. And he was caught when he was 15. So why does this matter to the Students' Union? I think it matters because education is a fundamental right, and throughout that time he has been denied access to beginning education. Actually, after, how do I go back?
The left arrow on the keyboard.
Okay. Actually, after this was taken in 2002, at the very end of the interrogation videos, while the agents were leaving, he asked them if they have any books. So education was at the top of his mind during that period of time. And King's University, it's a small Christian university in Edmonton, have actually stated that he'd be welcome as a student there. So this would mean he can receive post-secondary education without any fear of discrimination. And I believe that's something we should work towards. But what stands in his way to receive an education? Racism, discrimination, physical assault, and legal challenges. He's faced all four of them. And as you saw in that photo that's circulating, if you read any article that's against him, you'll see reference to the photo with the severed hands. The photo's fake. So there's a lot of misinformation about this case. His education level. So he currently has grade 10 level of education equivalent to Canadian standards. So he's studying the Canadian curriculum, and he's very interested in the sciences. He wants to eventually go to med school. And in 2 years, he can start applying to universities. And since he's in Edmonton, a logical, and his family's moved, well, his base is in Edmonton now, it makes sense for him to go to Edmonton universities. Now, Dr. Arles, who's supposed to be here, however, she'll be at the university next week on Monday. And she's an associate professor at King's University. She was the one who designed the curriculum for Omar. And she's quoted as saying, Omar is an enthusiastic and hardworking student despite adverse learning conditions. The way she actually interacts with him is, I have a friend who went to see Omar on Saturday, and you have to go through all this weird security, and then you go in a courtyard, they bring out dogs to sniff you, and then they bring you in this room, and you're like put in a cage, full of glass, like box, and Omar is on the other side, separated by glass. And this is how Arlette teaches Omar face-to-face. She can't even take his work. You're not allowed to take anything. They have to mail it. So it's very tough, and it's difficult. So what can we do? What can the SU do? I believe we can pass policy where the SU states that we'll do everything in our power to provide a safe space for Omar to get education, and pressure the university administration to take a similar stance as King's College. As the SU, we're the voices of 40,000 students, so our voice would be extremely powerful in this issue. And then we can also give them the option of attending a secular university. King's College is, it's not secular, but if he chooses to come to the U of A and, I don't know, go to med school eventually or go into the sciences, then at least give them that option. And during the meeting, my friend, I was trying to get a statement from him, but once again, she's not allowed to take anything from him. But she was telling him how she's in philosophy and how university isn't that great with papers and all that. And then his reply was, nothing can replace the university experience. And he said that on Saturday. So that's my presentation. It was relatively short. I just wanted to get the information to you guys. I left quite a bit of time for questions. Does anyone have any questions for me? Can I ask questions for the rest of my time?
Like, can you ask questions?
Can I have question period?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. You can direct, or if you want, I can direct whatever you prefer.
Oh, you can direct.
Sure. Yeah. Councillor Redden?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, people that are incarcerated right now, do they have access to university as we're trying to give them the safe space? So would it be a measure of equality? So like people that are incarcerated for the same amount of time for similar kinds of things, are they able to have a correspondence to university, or separate for just him?
Well, I haven't looked into that. I can get back to you. However, I'm in the Rotary Club, and one of the Rotary Club members, he actually was a former drug trafficker, and while he was in university, he finished his psychology degree. So, and that was, I think, in the 90s or 80s.
while he was incarcerated?
Yeah, while he was incarcerated, he took university courses. I don't know if that's still the case, if he can still take university courses now. But his parole hearing is in July, and he should be released in 3 years, and he can start applying in 2 years. So I don't know if he would be taking university courses in prison. I hope not. I hope he'd actually be in person. I don't know if that answers your question. Well, doesn't answer your question fully, but I can get back to you on that specific if prisoners are able to receive university education.
Thank you.
Sorry. And also, we should be careful to realize that he hasn't been tried under Canadian law. He's only been tried under not even a U.S. military court, but Guantanamo Bay Military Tribunal. So it's a very weird position.
Thank you. Governor Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're a little quiet, but Councillor Mohammed should be able to hear you at least.
Okay, good. Yes, thank you very much for the presentation, Councillor Mohammed. I was wondering, in terms of steps moving forward, what can we do, or interested councillors, what can interested councillors do to work with you moving forward on this potential policy, or sort of what are the steps for moving forward? SU council-wise.
Yeah, so the first step I took was to get in contact with his legal team. When I told their legal team, they were very excited. So the next step would be to just email me and ask me about the potential policy that I'll hopefully table fairly soon. So get in contact with me, that'd be the best next step. However, the best thing for this case would be to actually write a letter to Omar yourself. Or if you want, my friend is meeting him on Saturday again. So if you want him to get a message from you, email me just a short blurb, and he'll hear what you have to say. And that's huge emotionally. Yeah. So just get in contact with me. That's the major next step, I guess.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you. Councillor Binchik?
Thanks, and then I have two questions. I'm not sure if you can ask both of them.
I would prefer to ask one, and I'll add you back onto the list if there's time.
With all due respect, I'm just wondering whether there would be any psychological support provided to him if he did attend the university, provided his very unique background and some traumatic experiences.
Yeah, if you look in the booklet, he's actually had a top left guy who's actually his psychologist. And he actually published, this page, that guy, in Guantanamo Bay. And throughout the time, he's actually dealt with it extremely well. However, he already does have the support in place when he gets out of prison. He has all that necessary support. So it wouldn't be anything the university has to provide. However, we do have the mental health wellness center. So he could obviously, go to that for extra support. And my friend was also telling me, her name's Muna, by the way, she's VP External of Amnesty International on campus. If you look at sketchings of him, like this, so there's him when he was 15, there's him now. He kind of looks like a big, it looks like someone that could beat you up, right? But then when you see him in person, she was telling me that he's a very, skinnier than me, a very, scrawny, very shy man. So when he walked in, he was smiling ear to ear because he actually saw someone else, right? So it's very tough because he's been in prison since he was 15 and now he's 26, right? So there'd obviously be a lot of psychological needs that have to be dealt with, and thankfully those supports are in place. But I think it'd be amazing for him to just get our support and to actually come to campus and be a free man, right?
Thank you. Councillor Borden.
Okay. Before I ask the question, I'm sorry I have to be on here, but how do you think this fits into our preview of the students?
What do you mean by that?
Preview.
What does preview mean? Sorry.
How do you think this relates to us, our mission statement? We have to take the students at the U of A. No matter how we feel about this or how touching it is and everything, how is it our business? Because relativeness, it isn't.
Yeah. There's the argument that the SU advocates for issues that relate to students, correct? And that's what you're referencing. I believe that we should advocate for issues that students care about. So I've talked to students from the Muslim Students Association, Amnesty, International on campus and a majority of other groups, and they're very supportive of this idea. Now, like, this is an education issue. The way you release the students, like, it won't bring down our tuition or anything, right? However, it's just the right thing to do, honestly, and it won't take many resources to actually do this, like to put out the symbolic statement that we will pressure the university to take a similar stance and all that. I think the way it relates to our mission statement is that it's an issue that is controversial, but it's an issue that students do care about, and student organizations have gone out and called for him to be released. And I think that as a counselor, I should represent the interests of those. Now, I don't know if they're the minority, but if they're the minority, we should still hear what the minority has to say. Now, I can provide you with a more detailed response by email. I don't know if I answered all aspects of your question, but...
Just in case you want to see this, this is something that's coming through here. So you can choose to defer or not.
Oh, yeah, can I defer to Brent Kelly, actually, for this question? Can I?
Yeah.
I defer to Brent Kelly.
Governor Kelly?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, and just to go to Councillor Mills' point, speaking terms can be deferred as they would like. So, right. Governor Kelly, go ahead.
Absolutely. Well, to hopefully provide some sort of insight into the question of, in purview, is this relevant? If anyone interested would like to take a look at the SU strategic plan, under the strategic plan, there's a number of values listed. Two of which are citizenship and compassion. And under compassion, it lists, supporting human rights, dignity, needs, and talents of all within an inclusive, diverse, and safe community. And under citizenship, it says, we value fostering an environment that encourages critical thinking, leadership, personal growth, professional development, et cetera, et cetera. So under the Students' Union's strategic plan, it specifically references human rights, compassion, openness, as well as citizenship. So, in fact, in the strategic plan of the Students' Union, which the Students' Union is bound by through Bylaw 4000, we have this would clearly fall under, elements of the Students' Union strategic plan. So this certainly does fall under our purview, both in discussing and potentially taking action on.
Thank you. Hopefully most people heard you. It was relatively loud. It was nice and quiet in here. So, Councillor Bannister.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Peter, and thank you for your presentation. I have two questions, so if you can plot me back onto that. My first question, though, is what is the goal here? Is the goal to, like, completely submerge him in university culture? Is he going to be, like, just attending normal classes, blah, blah, blah? Or is it more, are we more trying to offer him a more specialized program, like, more one-on-one-ish, or something more altered towards his unique case? Like, I'm unclear of what we're really trying to achieve here.
Yeah, so personally, what he wants is to just be like any other Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
Well, any other student. So essentially right now he has a special program. That special program is just attended so that he can eventually reintegrate into society by just walking down quad like any other student and not fearing any repercussions. So the general goal is to have him in that aspect. However, that there is risk when people find out if he chooses to attend the U of A, he could attend KIPPS, but if he chooses to attend the U of A, there could be a lot of, well, to read any article about this, at least half are fairly negative or from Sun News or whatever, right? And they're pretty aggressive about how they look at him. They consider him a convicted terrorist and all that, right? So there could be discrimination in that aspect. So just to be an ordinary student, but if those cases do come up of him being discriminated against, that we would take unilateral action to make sure that it doesn't happen, right?
Because I find the concept of, like, we support him, the university wants to support his, like, cause, very vague. Like, so if we do achieve this, will we be offering him a specialized program? Like, that's kind of what I'm asking.
No, he'll apply like any other student.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
Yeah.
Councillor Speakman?
I hate getting my information from the faceless internet, so can you tell me more about his case? I'm confused about, like, who... like which body was like pressing charges? Is that was like, was it Canada and like he was held in Guantanamo? And then like specifically in here, I was confused about like that he was the Federal Court of Canada said that he was his human rights were violated, but then also the Supreme Court said that the government of Canada violated his constitutional rights. So I'm just like, what happened to this guy and who's the instigator?
Do I have 10 minutes?
12 minutes.
Okay, so I'll. So this doesn't really mention the specific incident that happened. So essentially, I mentioned the 4-hour bombing and then the U.S. military team going in. When they went in, this next minute is so controversial that there's multiple, scenarios that people imagine, right? But what did happen was a grenade was thrown, and that grenade exploded and killed an American soldier. Now, when they were clearing the compound, they found that one of the three people in the compound, three or four, were alive, and that was Omar. So they assumed Omar threw the grenade. However, he was actually shot in the back twice, so the other side essentially says, and by another soldier accounted that when he saw him, his hands were to a wall, and he shot the person whose hands were to the wall. So there's multiple cases of what happened. Some people say he threw the grenade, some people say he didn't throw the grenade, or it was impossible for him to throw the grenade, or some people even say it was an American grenade and it was friendly fire. So that minute of whether the grenade was thrown or not is insanely controversial. But right after that happened, they captured him, they put him to a U.S. military hospital, they put him to Bagram Air Base, and they interrogated him because his father, and this is the crucial part, his father, during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, essentially met Osama bin Laden, and during that time he set up orphanages and all that, and through his connection with him, the government, Canadian and U.S. government, believes that his father was financing their operations.
So
right?
He's kind of being interrogated by like U.S. and Canadian military as an Afghan.
Well, not Canadian military.
No,
but the U.S. military. So they wanted all the information they could out of Bagram, and then they flew him to Guantanamo Bay, where he was without charge for 2 years, and then they put on these war crime charges. His trial went on up to 2010. Now the Supreme Court says the Canadian government violated his rights by sending the CSIS agents to Guantanamo Bay. They didn't send diplomatic staff; they sent spies to interrogate him.
Okay.
So they believe that, when you watch the video of the interrogation, it's extremely, extremely, extremely inhumane. On the back page, there's an excerpt from the interrogation, with, like, the agents didn't care about him, essentially. All they wanted was information about his father when you listen to their questions. So that's the incident with the grenade, and then also after that, the Supreme Court said that the CSIS interrogators violated his rights, thereby the Canadian government violated his human rights. Yeah, but the Americans were the ones that were doing the torture. And also, the reason why this was done in a Guantanamo Bay military tribunal is that they can use evidence obtained by enhanced interrogation techniques, which is torture. So, strenuous positions and all that, or whatever. Actually, with his bullet wounds, they'd lift up his arms and tie them up and keep them in that position, and it would be very painful for him so that he would have to answer questions. Or I'm sure you saw the photos from Abu Ghraib, I think that's what the prison was called. But yeah, he was subjected to a wide range of things. So that's the reason why they put it in that court. So, and it's condemned by the UN and most Western nations. Yeah.
Councillor Henwell.
Okay, so I'm just wondering what, if there's actually changes, if you think there's actually changes to be made. So if we, like, Governor Kelly was talking about, like, our mission statement, right?
Yeah.
And it's to represent undergraduate students. That's kind of the core mission statement, right? It's to represent, the 30,000 undergrads that are at university right now.
Yeah.
And under that is compassion and human rights and things like that. So if he becomes an undergraduate student, aren't we already, protecting him and putting him in a safe space like all the other undergraduate students that we advocate for? And then there is a student code of behavior that would make it so he's in a safe space. And, we obviously wouldn't allow that, but do we have to make do you think it's bad to make a concession and to set that precedent for one person when When we make that stance, it's just reaffirming what we are.
Yeah. I believe that his case is so incredibly unique that we have to take a special action in the sense that I don't think any of the 30,000 students here have been held in Guantanamo Bay for a decade. So I believe that because of that gross human rights violations that we should be able to provide, that we should take this action. Sorry, I missed the first part of your question, which was, because you had two parts of it. What was the first part?
I can't remember. We already have the idea that we already have these.
So, and then also this ties into the admission process. If you look at what King's, I don't want to go over that. The King's University said that if he applied, he'd be treated like any other student. Now, I don't know if the university can deny him for whatever reason, but like it's just to make sure that there's no bias in the application process. That's one portion of it. Like King's University essentially stated that he'd be treated like any other student, and because of this extraordinary situation, I think we should put out that statement. And if we do that, then we'll be the first secular university to do so. Otherwise, he may fear attending these institutions for, I don't know, institutional discrimination, whatever, because all these biases could come into play throughout the admission process or even when he's a student. And also, like, it would be extremely controversial. Like, obviously, when King's University put out the statement, there was a lot of media attention bashing their university by essentially saying, why are you letting a terrorist come and everything, right? But, you know, often doing the right thing is the difficult thing to do. And I think we should take that difficult stance and set this precedence, because doing this will do a few things. The first thing will be showing him that we value his education and we value that what was done to him wasn't right and that he lost 10 years of his life for no reason and he's still losing years of his life. And also that he'd be treated like any other student here. So I don't know. I think if he did apply and we didn't do anything, he'd be put in a very, 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 very weird position. He's been put in a weird position all his life. So that's why I think we need to take this special action. And he's not just an average student. He's gone through, you know, quite a bit in his life. And I mentioned that before. Sorry, I'm like dancing around the question. If you send me a more detailed thing, once again, I'll get back to you. Okay. And you want to make sure everyone has their, you know, questions.
Again, I don't know if you want to take that deferral or not.
No, I'll just continue.
Okay.
Yeah.
Councillor Valdez?
Yeah, I just have a quick question. Have you tried running this by any other organization other than the Students Union?
Amnesty International put out a statement. I can email that letter out if you'd like. Any other organization, the United Nations? Well, actually, if you go here, the United Nations, General Roman Blair, a professor at the Faculty of Law at the UFT, he's a defense lawyer, an archbishop. So, what do you mean, like, student organizations?
Have you gone, like, and met by other organizations?
Like, other student organizations?
Outside of student organizations.
Like, political groups?
Yeah.
Well, I tried advocating for it politically, but a lot of MPs don't want to meet with me on this issue because, well, we only have one seat that's not conservative, and the conservative government has been one of the only Western governments to essentially refuse to allow him back in the country, right? And they just did last year. So I've tried, and they don't want to hear it. But I believe that if the Students' Union takes action on this, it will embarrass the university administration, and it will embarrass MPs to take action on this, because it shows that we have a moral compass and they frankly don't.
Councillor Grilke.
In this whole thing, you've said, are you looking for the SU to work on a policy regarding this, or do you just want the council to release a statement saying...
Yeah. Well, in order to release a statement, they would have to have a political policy. So I'm aiming for a political policy. And if I go back, I can... Yeah, so this would be the 3 points on the policy plus whatever... Like, past policy with the SU states that they'll do everything in their power to provide a safe space for Omar to get educated, pressure the university administration to take similar stances as King's College, and give them the option to attend a secular university. So these could be the first principles. They may not be, well, they will be in there, but there may be additional first principles.
Well, 3 minutes left. Councillor Hodgson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was just curious how many student groups you've talked to and what student groups specifically.
Yeah.
And that if you thought that from the opinion you've received this student groups, from these student groups, it's fair to basically make a decision that this is what the majority of students would want.
Yeah. Well, 2 points to that. The first one is the groups I talked to. Since the Muslim don't meet in the summer, it is the Amnesty International, it is the Muslim Students Association. They're the ones who actually approach me. So that's hopefully in the next 2 weeks I can get their opinion of other campus groups. But then I would also like to say that the SU is a representative democracy. So we take stances on behalf of the students, like they invest power in us. So it's not a direct democracy. However, there was a poll released that said I think 60-70% of Canadians across, like all Canadians, believe that he should be brought back to Canada and tried under Canadian law. He was brought back to Canada, but he wasn't tried under Canadian law, right? So I think when you eventually do get public opinion, I mean, when you do research into this and once you gain knowledge on this case, you realize that it's black and white. If we take everything away, all the political aspects, and just focus on his age, he's a child soldier. So, and we have child soldiers who come here under the WISP program. So would we like it if they were in prison? So I think this issue is fairly black and white about what is right or wrong. So I think we can act on this by saying that this is wrong. And if you like, you can actually meet with his lawyer. You can meet with his lawyer on Monday in ETLC Lecture Hall 1 at 7 p.m. and talk to his lawyer. And if there's enough interest, if there's 5 or so counselors, they will set aside time personally for the Students' Union where you can grill his defense lawyer and you can grill Arlette, who is his, who's his, I guess, teacher and mentor for now. Is there 5 or more people who'd be interested in going on Monday? And if so, I could set aside time for you guys.
Again, we don't
can I take a straw poll?
We don't actually allow straw polls in Robert's Rules, but again, I would encourage anyone to speak to Councillor Mohammed sort of offline.
Yeah.
And he could get that information from you.
How many questions do we have?
We have 3 questions left. Unfortunately, we have hit the 30-minute mark.
Okay. Can I extend it to 5 minutes?
Okay.
Yes. 5 to 10
okay,
minutes.
So motion to suspend standing orders to extend the presentation another 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Councillor Mohammed, is there a seconder for that motion? Councillor Douglas, again, requires a 2/3 majority vote. All those in favor? Okay, all opposed? That passes 11-5. So we are extended another 10 minutes, so
okay.
Until 9:18.
The last few questions.
Councillor Bishop.
Well, actually, I would like to...
Okay, Councillor Bannister?
My question is also been answered.
Okay, Councillor Borden?
Have you considered going to a body within, like, the University of Alberta that works with more community, like the Senate, because we are, again, representing undergrad students.
Yeah.
We have 30,000, and this is one, and they are more community-based, and maybe they have more appropriate powers to do what you want to do instead of just using this to do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, we can get both to do it. Yeah. Like I don't know how to get in contact with the Senate. I can. Hopefully, people in this room know how to. Yes, I can. I'll meet with Vice President Woods to find out how to meet with the Senate. I haven't considered that because, frankly, I have no idea what the Senate does. And I don't think many people do. But yeah, I'll look into that. But I believe as the SU, we do have a political say on such issues as. Well, we're taking stats on the municipal election, so I think that's politics, right? Yeah.
Okay. Councillor Chivone?
Oh, I did.
Hey. So, can you hear me?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, cool. First, like, I'd like to just say, going back to a comment you said a while ago, I don't think we should be aiming to embarrass MPs or our university. That shouldn't be the aim of any of our policies, I don't think. But I'd really just like to ask that, like, I know you've kind of mentioned this already, but why is it up to us, like, an institution that Mr. Cotter has no ties to, why are we responsible for his interests? Because, like, there shouldn't be any discrimination in terms of acceptance policy or anything like that, but that's really, I mean, the university administration does all the acceptance and application process. That's not even under our purview whatsoever. So how do we really have an effect on this? And even if we just release a statement saying, you know, we think he should be allowed access to the university, well, he should. We can agree with that maybe, but how does that affect anything, really?
Yeah, so to address the first point, the word embarrassing, I shouldn't have used that word. I'm on a slide now where I show that I use the language pressure. I think that's a better wording, which is to not embarrass, it may embarrass them, but to pressure the university and MPs to take action. By doing this, it'll be setting a precedent that they hopefully will follow. And also, why are we talking about his interests? Well, we're talking about his educational aspirations. And he says he wants to go to university. So as a result, as a student union group that represents undergraduate students, we should advocate for him when he eventually comes here. Also, the other part of your question, which tell me if I'm wrong with your interpretation, but you were saying that what effect would this have, if I'm correct, or?
Well, essentially, like, you're trying, from what I'm understanding, you're trying to write a policy where the student union advocates on his behalf, essentially.
Well,
is that what I'm trying to understand?
Well, sure, but that's not exactly what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to do is kind of threefold. It's to state that the SU is a $10 million organization, and they have services all across campus, and they're a major player in university life. And to go back to his quote, he says that nothing can replace the university experience. So I think our role stands in that we'll be providing him with that university experience, since the SU, you know, is a major player on campus life. Also, the second point would be just to pressure other bodies, such as the Senate or the House of Commons. And the third is to also give him the option to attend a secular institution, to show him that there's other options. If he doesn't want to go to King's, he can go to the U of A, so to provide him with a choice. So I think that answers, does that answer the effect portion of your question? Did I miss anything at all?
Well, it does, but it doesn't answer to me how...
I'm sorry, I am going to cut you off there, Councillor Schiaffoni. I don't want to engage in too much of a dialogue back and forth. I will encourage you to ask another question if you have another question.
That?
Yeah, you can certainly come back to it.
Okay.
Vice President Chellen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You talked a little bit about sort of power and the role that the SU can play in $10 million organization services, etc.
Yeah.
Things like that. And I agree that the SU has got a lot of power. I was wondering if you could perhaps relate this clause back to the SU's mandate. And yes, we do have a strategic document that talks about how we achieve our mandate and talks about values of citizenship and compassion. But those values are in the achievement of our mandate, and I don't know if Council will permit me to read from papers for our mandate.
Any objection?
I would mind.
Go ahead.
So our mandate as a student union is to provide for the administration of student affairs, including the development and management of student committees, the development and enforcement of rules relating to student affairs, and the promotion of the general welfare of the students consistent with the purpose of the post-secondary institution.
Yeah, so that statement alone is extremely difficult to interpret because I find it's often vague. I think that we take actions that are often political anyways. Like, for example, we are taking stances in the municipal election about which candidates we like and which candidates we don't like, and I could argue that that doesn't relate to our mandate in that sense. However, in this aspect, if I was a lawyer, I could probably find a roundabout way to go back to it. But I think that's really open up to your interpretation. And the way I see the SU is as a representative democracy. And the reason why I'm not doing this because I'm a bleeding heart, you know, liberal. I'm doing this because this legal team requested that, you know, when I brought up the idea, they loved it and they wanted to move forward with it. So this is what his legal team would like to do, and this is what he would like to do. So I'm here for him. I'm also here for the Amnesty Group. I'm also here for the MSA. And the Muslim Students Association represents, you know, a portion of campus. And I'm here to represent their interests. So I don't know, that mandate is often decided that we should be focusing on issues that relate to students. But as I said before, we should focus on issues that students care about. And I believe that students do care about this issue. Great.
Thank you. Councillor Mills.
Hi, y'all hear me?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So I've got a question about, I guess, the implications of talking about this. And I guess thinking it's fair for all individuals if we're going to make a, you know, essentially a special case for this one individual to attend the U of A. Is that going to, you know, transfer on to other individuals who have received or gone through hardships in their life to attend the U of A? And are we then going to have to advocate for all students who got, or all individuals, sorry, who've gone through hardships to attend the U of A? And just thinking about the ramifications of what this will do.
Yeah. I think his case is so specific that the idea of worrying about something like this happening again is extremely unlikely to have a Canadian citizen tried under foreign law and then ending up in Edmonton and then having someone to go to the university while going to university. I think it's so like unlikely of a scenario that it isn't really that relevant to worry about at this point. To your point about students who go through hardships, there are students who are on campus who go through hardships, but that word is extremely vague, like maybe poverty. Is that what you're trying to, like, poverty, violence?
Or? In a situation, I'm sure that there are individuals who, you know, were mistreated by the criminal system within Canada.
Yeah.
They're going to have to advocate for them to attend the school at the U of A?
Well,
I could probably find cases of, you know, youth who were mistreated by the criminal system, and that is a shame, and that should not be happening. But do we then need to advocate for them to attend the U of A?
I think with this policy, it wouldn't apply to them, in the sense that he was not tried under Canadian law. It was like Guantanamo Bay Military Tribunal. So I think in that sense, that's an irrelevant point, because, like, if students are mistreated by the criminal justice system in Canada, that they probably wouldn't get the same media attention and the same controversy that Omar has gotten. So I don't think we should worry about having to treat, like, having to apply this policy to other individuals, because really this unique situation only really applies to Omar. And if this does happen again, I hope we do take a stance on the person it happens to, but I don't think it's likely that it will happen again. So I'm sorry if I seem like I'm dismissing your point, but I just don't see it as unlikely of happening in the future.
Thank you. We've now reached the end of the presentation. I would encourage, while there's still a number of people on the list, I would encourage, just in the interest of time, that perhaps this conversation continue in offline. I'm sure Councillor Mohammed would be happy to answer any questions you might have. So thank you very much for the presentation, Councillor Mohammed. With that, we're going to move to executive committee reports. Again, based on time, I would encourage you to only speak if there's something really pertinent. Any executive reports? Vice President Woods.
Really, really brief. Just here, the President and I just returned from a Canadian Licensing Association policy and strategy conference. I provided a few of the all the 12 priorities that the National Advocacy Committee, which I am chair of, endorsed. I just wanted to inform the committee of a few other asks that I thought were very important, specifically pertaining to what I told campus that I would work on if I was elected. There were several mental health policies passed at the federal level to hopefully increase use of data towards mental health, as well as work on collaboration between the provinces and the federal government towards mental health initiatives, as well as looking at funding. I'm also very proud to say that I spoke in favor of two international student asks, multiple entry visas, as well as off-campus work permits. I was the only one to speak on these, and they both passed, which I was very happy about. And then finally, there was an open education resources piece that was also passed. So as a whole, CASA passed some very, very good policies, and I look forward to lobbying on them on behalf of the students.
Thank you. Vice President Lau.
I got something I'm really excited about. I had a brief meeting with the president of the Music Students Association, and he brought up this one small concern. I asked him, like, you know, why aren't these music students, like, practicing out in the open more? And they're like, well, you know, they don't really know like where they can practice. They don't want to be disturbing people. And I was wondering how nice it would be to contact like faculties and departments to kind of have like allotted locations and times where, you know, students could come out and play music. Maybe find an open space that's away from classrooms. Find like maybe a time where there aren't going classes nearby, and allows and it's almost like set up a schedule across campus where students can go and whether it be, you know, just practice or play like a 10-minute performance or something like that, just to kind of improve the atmosphere on campus. And I want to see, like, you know, if counselors are interested in that, it'd be sweet if we could all kind of go back to our own departments, talk to our staff in the offices, and ask them, hey, you know, we're trying to work on this like one larger project. It really like includes the atmosphere. If anyone has any comments to make, feel free to ask them. Question period.
Thank you, Vice President Lau. Vice President Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Hello, Council. Two major things that are on my plate, which I hope to close at tonight's Council meeting. The first one is the QP negotiations. Mark DuMichel will give a presentation, so we'll are we suspended standing orders with the hope of ratifying. Then I'll explain further once we get to the motion. And also for the sub coffee shop, BFC met and we are recommending council to approve the allocation. We'll touch on that too, but it would be very great if we were able to do it.
Thank you.
And my daily grind. Squad.
Thank you. Board and committee reports. Any committee chairs complete? Councillor Borden?
Hello. Just wanted to let you all know that last CAC meeting, we made it so that you can stay on Skype in in-camera session. That's new and exciting. Here in the court, it's like, oh, CAC did something. So feel free to come to CAC. It flies on the 16th. There might be Timbits, and you can talk about how nice my tan is from Mexico.
Thank you, Councillor Borden. Any other communicators? Seeing none, we will continue on to question period. Again, in the interests of time, I'm going to wave my magic speaker wand and limit questions and answers to 2 minutes apiece. Councillor Redmond.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. This question is directed to President Kuzma. So recently I heard rumors through people in the industry related to engineering program electives. Basically, the rumors stated that the engineering program electives, specifically the nanotechnology option, were funded by industry and not by the university itself, and that those industry players were going to withdraw the money they fund them with, and those programs would be cancelled after the people that are currently enrolled in the programs graduate. Are you aware of anything regarding this issue, or what kind of action we can take to try and get the university to continue such programs for students?
Yeah, this is Councillor Redmond kind of raised this issue with me a while back since the email, and had the opportunity to follow up with the information. That's the one of the great reasons why we have a strong relationship, or why we want to have a strong relationship, that is the councillors can engage with us, and they can us, and they tell back to us. And yeah, I think we'll try to see if we can follow more information on that, but it would be fantastic if engineering students decided to follow up and kind of share and tell back. Thanks for raising the question and putting on the radar.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing no.
Councillor Green? For
yep, go ahead.
President Kuzma. I was wondering what relationship, if any, does BSU have with Octavia Federation students?
Well, very limited to non-existent. I mean, like, we work with some CFS schools on something called the Canada Student Horizon Group. I think it's a group of student unions that essentially separated that gets some cash from travel cuts lawsuits, from shares that we have in travel cuts as a result of a lawsuit that happened with the Canadian Federation of Students years ago. But besides that, it's pretty non-existent. The CFS and PMS Students Association don't really work with one another that often. But it's not like, you know, there's CFS schools where all of a sudden I'm going to work with them. It's opportunities that's not having the opportunities that we have to work with one another.
Thank you. Any other questions? Councillor Graham, yeah, go ahead.
I have another question for the executive committee. I'm trying to find it in here, but I think in your report, there was like $2,200 allocated to something, and I was wondering if you could expand on that. Sorry, I'm trying to find it somewhere.
I'll suggest that go to the president, and if the president wishes to defer to any of the vice presidents, he can do something.
Sorry, it's on the second page. Wild Woods moved that executive committee approve a project allocation for program.
So, President Kuzma, you can feel free to defer to.
I'll defer to Vice President Chuck.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. So, that's funding that the SU is using for an internal staff wellness program. It came out of a recommendation from a former EPA Torba, who suggested that staff need more activities to promote physical health and wellness during work, in particular to balance stressful work environments and also to build a greater sense of staff community. So $2,200 is accessible to all permanent and ongoing staff, and it's used for things such as balls. I think there's a football that we bought that rent for an outdoor soccer field, basketball courts once a month. Basic health and wellness facilities to promote sort of an active living and so on. So nothing too controversial. I think I'll defer to Chris for the design and stuff.
Yeah, just a quick, look where it is. But most of the money is going to rentals of venues. Just so like when it's booked, we can go out and people on the field Wednesday, they would book the space. And just ensure that staff have a place to go when it is, that's fine.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Councilor Mohammed?
This is direct to our Vice President Lau. In your report, you mentioned a lobster can do wants to fix a loophole or something with the e-pass.
Yeah.
You're caught with the e-pass, you get fined. $250. Like, one staffer got mine, they put a $250 fine. That was actually thrown out because they put the wrong date on the card. So it's very, very close. So how's that going along?
The update with that right now is I'm talking to an associate with ETS to get in touch with the right contact that will deal with more of the procedures. Because it's not so much about bylaw amendment, right? If you don't have proof of purchase, you don't.
Yeah.
But it's more so the procedure of like what's the appeal process look like. So I still have yet to get with the right get in contact with the right individual, but I'll let you know.
Thank you. Any other questions? Councillor Graham?
Another question, someone from the executive committee. But just in terms of the Golden Bears and the Legacy Fund, and like the negotiations with the University of River surrounding that, about like the defunding of like the varsity team or whatever, I was just wondering how, because it was mentioned in someone's report, I was wondering how that was going, and I was just wanting more information on that and how you think that will go.
As with any question to the execs, I'm going to give it to the president, and then the president can defer, perhaps, to the VP also.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If you have a question, Councilor Graham, can you refer? Right now, we are talking with the director, Ian Reed, from Athletics, about the whole process between that, because it was all brought up because of the field hockey cutting. And we sort of had to dig back of what the reason why the why the fund was created in the first place. So we're meeting again in a week's time, but we've consulted our lawyer and we've got an opinion there. So we're potentially looking at doing an MOA with them, or we might also just have a letter clarifying the process going forward so such an incident doesn't occur.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, we will close question period, and we will continue on to board and committee business. Item 6A. Again, slightly revised wording, so I'll read it out. Woods moves that, upon the recommendation of the Senate Nomination Committee, this is the inserted part, the Council Administration Committee recommend the following three student representatives to be appointed to the Senate. Navneet Kinda, Sean Wallace, and Jeffrey K.
Yeah.
Kissel, I think.
Sorry?
I think it's Coach Kizzle. I don't know.
Coach Kizzle. Thank you very much, Vice President Woods. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Councillor Zhang, thank you very much. Vice President Woods to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I can't go my agenda this because if I is this discussing the individuals in particular, I'll have to move to the camera because that's an HR type thing. These are the final decisions of the Senate Nomination Committee. If anybody has questions about the process, the interview process, if anybody has any questions about the actual interviews or why I made these selections, feel free to ask, but be advised that I will be moving the council into camera at that point.
Thank you very much. And to clarify what Vice President Woods is referring to, Bylaw 500 requires that any issues relating to personnel or individual interviews or anything like that are considered confidential, and so they would have to be moved in camera. Is there any debate? Councillor Graham?
I have a question for the floor, or I have a question for Vice President Woods. How many candidates were considered?
It is in question period, so we can't just go back and forth, but you could choose to use one of your speaking turns to speak, or you could wait and see if other questions come out and then answer it a little bit later. So any further debate? Any further debate? Councillor Mohammed?
I'm going to be supporting this, however, I think a future reference we should. I think a future reference we should do more public outreach about what the Senate is, because if their goal is to engage the community, they're not doing a very good job of that. So if we're going to point people to it, we should at least let people know what the Senate is and what their purpose is as an organization. So I'll be supporting it, however, next time we should do a better job at that.
Thank you. Any further debate? And I should mention, I'm just going to extend my new rule of 2-minute speaking turns for the rest of this meeting for all the motions, simply in the interest of time. Councillor Graham?
Again, I don't know who the other candidates are, so I can't speak at length. I know some of these people personally, and they're all really cool. However, I find it really disconcerting when the three student representatives are an ex-counselor, I think someone involved in DIBOR, like ex-tribune, and another ex-counselor. I don't think that, I guess there's like overlap in people who would be interested in students counseling the Senate. I think that's weird, and I don't think that's representative of the people who could actually be on the Senate. That's not really an argument, it just makes me...
Mr. Speaker, motion to move in camera.
Vice President, was to move in camera, and I was actually going to mention that was right on the fringe. That would be allowable ex-camera, but you would have to be careful not to go any further into discussing the candidates at all in camera. So there is a motion to move in camera. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Councillor Zhang, thank you very much. So this just requires a simple majority vote. If anyone doesn't know what in camera is right now, just rise on a point of parliamentary inquiry right now. All those in favor of moving in camera? Any opposed? Okay, that motion's carried. We are now in camera.
You guys can come on back in now.
I want to see that.
Councillor Mohammed, did you have a point to
call for division?
Call for division, okay. So again, call for division doesn't require any vote or anything. If one member asks for it, then we do a vote by roll call. So, again, the motion is item 6A. Woods, I forget who seconded it, but it's on the recording, moves that upon the recommendation of the Senate Nomination Committee, the Council Administration Committee recommend the following three student representatives be appointed to the Senate: Navneet Kinda, Sean Wallace, and Jeffrey, I apologize, I won't pronounce your last name properly, Jeffrey Kay. So again, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through roll call. When I get to your name, you just say in favor, opposed, or abstain, and then we will proceed that way. President Kuzmu.
In favor.
Vice President Chellen.
He left the room.
Okay. Vice President Woods.
In favor.
Vice President Lay.
In favor.
Vice President Lau.
In favor.
Governor Kelly. Are you still there, Governor Kelly?
No.
I thought he was here. Governor Kelly going once, going twice. Up there, Vice President Chellen, we're doing division. Would you care to vote in favor, opposed, or abstain?
That's on blood.
You certainly can. Item 6A.
In favor.
Okay. Governor Kelly, if you get back before I finish voting, Robert's Rules allows you to change your vote until the time I announce the results. So if Governor Kelly gets back and he tells me how he wants to vote, he can certainly do that. Councillor Battelle?
Yes.
Councillor Borden?
In favor.
Councillor Mills is no longer there. Councillor Hanwell?
In favor.
Councillor Bannister?
In favor.
Councillor Chavone?
In favor.
Councillor Mohammed?
Opposed.
Councillor Gruelke?
In favor.
Councillor Minarski. Not here. Councillor Valdez.
In favor.
Councillor Corbett. Councillor Redman.
In favor.
Councillor Hamid. Councillor Morris. Councillor Nguyen. Councillor Champagne is gone. Councillor Speakman.
In favor.
Councillor Hodgson. Mr. Raman for Councillor Huang. Councillor Zhang.
In favor.
Councillor Graham.
Abstain.
Councillor Binchik.
In favor.
Councillor Douglas.
In favor.
So that motion passes 16 in favor, 1 opposed, and 2 abstentions. So with that, we will move to item 6B. Woods Vitale moved that, upon the recommendation of Policy Committee, that Students' Council create the Post-Secondary Learning Act Task Force based on the attached principles. And the principles are attached. Vice President Woods to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Hopefully this goes through quickly. We'll be doing nominations for this. Hopefully if it passes the next meeting, it'll likely fall on Wednesdays. This is just essentially a task force. My goal is to review the Post-Secondary Learning Act line by line and make student-based revisions in order that we can present it to other provincial lobby groups as well as the government. I will be making a minor amendment, but other than that, please feel free to voice any concerns if you have any.
Okay, any debates?
Motion to amend.
I'll allow debate before I entertain amendment if there is any. Seeing none, I'll entertain that amendment.
Brief amendment under section timeline. I would like it to read, the task force will begin meeting upon the approval of its existence by Students' Council and should conclude no later than August 31st, 2013, unless the committee feels its business has not been adequately completed.
Okay, sorry, so the last bit is added on, unless the...
Yeah, it should say, and should conclude no later.
Okay, so we're striking the words, its business?
Yes.
Okay.
Conclude no later than August 31st, 2013, unless the committee feels its business has not been adequately completed.
Okay, so again, to clarify, we are striking the words, its business, and then appending on the end, unless the committee feels its business has not been adequately completed. Is everyone clear on what the amendment is? Do we have a... Councillor Speakman, do you want clarification?
Yeah, well, which committee?
This is the Post-Secondary Learning Act.
So it's under timeline here, so... So at this point, we would just be asking if you're clear on what the wording change is, and then we can go into questions.
That is my question.
Okay.
In the amendment, you said... Unless the committee feels its business is not complete?
Yeah, this is just like, it's technically...
Okay, what I'm going to do first is, all I'm basically asking is whether people are unclear on the wording. So once we have the wording clarified, then I'll ask for a seconder, and then you can ask for a point of parliament or, you know, various points if you're unclear as to what's going on, or enter into debate on that. So, so we're all clear on that we're striking the words, its business, under timeline, and... appending to the end of it, unless the committee feels its business has not been adequately completed. Okay, do we have a seconder for that amendment? Councillor Gruelke, thank you very much. Vice President Woods to introduce, and then we can get into conversation.
It's just so that unless we haven't finished it by August 31st, we can keep going, is all this states. Is that if we're not done yet, we can keep working on it. Rather, otherwise, no matter how much we've finished, we would have to have been done and reported to council by after sometime August 31st.
Okay, any debates, or do you have a...
Is that maybe say task force then?
Okay, so that's... I'll allow that in debate, because that's going to sort of the intent of the amendment. So if you'd like, I can add you to the speaker's list. I'm going to go to Vice President Lau and then Councillor Speaker.
I just want to echo that, I think.
Can we make a friendly amendment?
Vice President Woods, I'll go on this conversation first. I will try and maintain a little bit of order and... without slowing things down too much. So, Vice President Lau, go ahead.
I'm concerned with the wording, whether it was the task force or a committee. Yeah, if it was the committee, then it should be.
Okay. Vice President Woods.
Motion to amend, please. Friendly, strike the word committee, replace it with task force.
Okay, so there's an amendment to the amendment. So to strike the word committee and replace it with the word task force. So it would read, unless the task force feels its business has not been adequately completed. Is there any objection? A friendly amendment is basically an amendment that it's generally non-controversial. It's generally editorial or typographical changes. When I ask if something's friendly, that basically just means we don't have to vote on it. It's just a quick way of dealing with things. If you object to it being friendly, it doesn't mean that you necessarily oppose it. It's just that you want to have a formal vote on it. So if someone objects, then we would have an actual vote. But is there any objection to that amendment, to the amendment being carried as friendly? Seeing none, we will continue debate on the amended amendment. Vice President Challen. Yes. Quorum is 15. We have two. I'll confirm that both are both my Skype people still here. Councilor Schiavone, you're here. Governor Kelly, are you here? No. Okay, we have one person on Skype.
2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 17.
So we do still have quorum.
Mr. Speaker, call the question.
There's a motion to call the question. I'm as much as I would prefer to be done as quickly as possible, I want to allow a little bit of debate, at least if there is any debate on the amendment. Seeing none, then we will go to question. So again, this is a vote on the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment? Okay, that motion carries. We are back to debate on the main motion. Any debate on the main motion? Seeing none, we will call to question. All those in favor of item 6B as amended? Any opposed? Okay, that motion is carried. Thank you very much. Now, ladies and gentlemen, standing orders requires us to take a 15-minute recess at 10 o'clock. Now, generally, the reason why that recess is there is because when we're in council chambers in U-Haul, we're kicked out at 10 o'clock and have to find a new place. I think this building's open later.
Motion to suspend standing orders.
Vice President Lay with a motion to suspend standing orders. Councillor Bannister
to allow
the meeting to continue without a recess at this time. Councillor Bannister seconds. All those in favor of suspending standing orders? Any opposed? Okay, that motion's carried. Thank you very much, folks. With that, we're moving to item 6C. It's on the late additions. Lay Douglas moves that upon the recommendation of the Budget and Finance Committee, that Students Council approve an allocation not to exceed $106,000 from the Capital Reserve for the purpose of constructing the Students Union Building coffee shop and upgrading the mechanical services in the food court. Vice President Lay to introduce.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, Council. As you all know, we are planning to build a coffee shop to replace the Jab Jab space and also to upgrade the mechanical services to allow OPA to replace the cramped down space and to operate without sinking, without making the food court smell like OPA, which would be bad. I sent an email and it was in my council report and there were numbers there, but I'll explain further in the debate.
Thank you. Any debates?
Okay.
Yeah. Vice President Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So just to introduce what's going on here, the sub coffee shop and the mechanical services upgrade is not part of the sub renovation. Otherwise, it would just be rolled into that. But then the reason why these are not, I outlined in my email, I'm not sure how many of you have read it, but the Jab Jab space was not in the scope of the sub renovation because it was so occupied and we didn't realize, or we didn't know that Jab Jab was going to leave. And also with OPA coming in, the food court is not part of the sub renovation, so it was a separate part. It was part of the RFP process for the food court. The amount, I sent out the email as well too, but we met as BFC and the amount is $106,000. And $86,000 of that is going to be for the coffee shop. And one of the main reasons why the cost is so high is because of the millwork, which is the
the interior furnishing touches, so like the counters and tabletops and such. And from that, or from the blueprint, we presented it to different construction companies and they bid on it. And so the one that we chose was the most reasonable option. And then the extra $20,000, which is for the mechanical services, that is a high estimate, but that's a worst case scenario. But the estimate is to be $10,000 to $15,000. Yeah, $10,000 to $15,000. And in the word in the motion, it's an allocation up to and not to exceed $106,000. So anything that doesn't, if it doesn't go over that, then it'll just go back into the capital reserve budget, of which we have around $150,000. And so there's money in the bank. And this is very important because it's a revenue-generating business. Currently, the operations from Crown Junk is in L'Express, and that won't be sustainable because we plan to open it up in the Jabba Jack space because we would essentially have a monopoly.
Thank you, Vice President Lay. What I will do really quickly is I'm going to pretend I heard a point of parliamentary inquiry because I think there's a number of people probably that aren't familiar with the capital reserve. Although I'm not the best person to explain it, I'm going to give Vice President Lay about 20 seconds to explain what the capital reserve is.
Capital reserve is a part of the budget where it funds capital projects, so building things.
Perfect. Thank you. With that, any further debate? Councillor Speakman.
Yeah, I am generally in support of this motion. I just wanted to say that I hope we get to be part of the process of it being built and hear more about it as it's ongoing, and also hoping that it will be a sustainable initiative of the Students' Union in accordance with all its policies and whatnot, and just having spoken somewhat over the last year with General Manager Mark DeMichel about heading towards maybe ideally one day a zero waste food court in sub. So I don't know. Just confuse that for later.
Thank you. Vice President Lau.
Similar to what Councillor Speakman mentioned, some of the main concerns that I've received from my constituent have been started with all we've got.
Thank you. Any further debate? Vice President Lay?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just continue on. One reason why there's urgency for having this allocation approved this meeting is because it takes about 6 weeks to produce the coffee shop, and we want to have the construction complete and the operations ready before the new year starts, and we want to have it done by mid-August so we can work out the kinks from that. And to address Councillor Speakman and Vice President Lau's concerns, one, all talk at the SU sells is fair trade. I'm not sure if it's fair trade organic, but then it's fair trade, and I think there'll be some form of a taste test, so I'm not sure how extensive that'll be, but if councillors would like to join, I'll see how I can get in that. Part of that, I'll put that aside, but then there will also be, we're looking to have part of the menu that will be gluten-free, and so that will be open for those who have celiac, and the colder coffee, I guess we'll address that with the taste testing, and I think that is all.
Thank you. Councillor Borden. Motion to call to question. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Councillor Grookey, thank you very much. All those in favour of calling to question? Any opposed? That motion carries. Item 6C on the late additions. All those in favor of item 6C? Any opposed? That motion carries. Thank you very much. Moving back to the main order paper, we are moving to item 7A. Lay moves to ratify the 2013 to 2016 Memorandum of Agreement between the University of Alberta Students' Union and Canadian Union of Public Employees Local 1368. Do we have a seconder for that motion? Vice President Woods, thank you very much. Vice President Lay to introduce.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. As you all were here for the presentation by General Manager Mark DeMichel, he outlined the presentation of the changes from the 2011 to 2013 QP contract. and this will be to ratify the 2013 to 2016 QP contract.
Thank you. Any debates? Vice President Lay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yeah, so the MOA that we're agreeing upon is ratify the agreement that's mutually agreed upon by the local QP chapter 1368 and also the SU. So the local chapter has already ratified it 2 Fridays ago, and now it's on our side to ratify the agreement. And so the ratification, it'll benefit both the unionized and non-unionized staff to make it equal for both sides. So I think that's something that's very important to highlight, and yeah, we'll just validate it going forward. So it's been a lot of work. I think there's been 4 days of negotiations where it's been dedicated to that. In my term, I think former Vice President Ospai and Ichima, he also spent a considerable amount of time. So there's a lot of agreements. We passed it through the exec, and they gave the blessing for it to go to council. So we hope you do the same as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Any debate? Any further? Councilor Graham?
I'm just wondering, like, this was special work, so I was wondering if somebody could speak more on like what the time sensitivity of this was, or just like, does it need to be passed right away? That's one question I had. Just one thing I noticed I thought was kind of disturbing and weird was just like a list of exemptions from like the categories that are exempted from the contract. And it's sort of weird that like we're a students' union and yet like all the student workers that work in SU, like not part of this. There sort of seemed to be more of like administrative staff and like senior managers and stuff. And yet like all the people that actually work for the SU are not represented, even in like smaller categories that don't have to pay like pension plans, whatever. You know, you can tailor it specifically, but I think just like a general exemption of just like if you're not in a union, you don't get any kind of representation or anything. I think that's kind of weird, and I think that's a really weird ethical stance for a student's union to take. But I'd be interested in hearing what other people have to say about it.
Thank you. Any further debate?
Point of parliamentary inquiry.
Vice President Lay with point of parliamentary inquiry.
How do I say that we might have to go in camera if people would like to discuss something?
There's two ways to do it. I mean, number one is to use a speaking turn and to say that precisely that. Number two is that you probably just made that point. And number three is that, in all likelihood, if you made a motion to go in camera, I think it would probably be implied that the reason for that is you probably had something you wanted to say in camera. So, with that, Vice President Lay, do you have a motion you would care to make? All right, do we have a seconder for that motion? Councillor Douglas, thank you very much. All those in favor of moving in camera? Any opposed? Motion's carried. Sorry again to our guests. Our apologies. Okay, so we've called the question, so we will proceed with a vote. Item 7A, Lay, forget who the seconder was, again it's on the recording, moves to ratify the 2013-2016 Memorandum of Agreement between the University of Alberta Students' Union and Canadian Union of Public Employees, Local 1368. Let me double check that I still have a quorum. Councillor Schiavone, are you still there? 16. We have 16. We do still have quorum. And with Schiavone, we have 17. Okay. Again, item 7A. All those in favor? Any opposed? That motion carries. With that, we're at the end of our agenda. We have one motion to adjourn. No. Oh, hold on. Abstention noted? Sure, yeah. Vice President Chellen, abstention noted on item 7A. Thank you very much. Motion to adjourn. Councillor Hanwell looks way too excited. Councillor Borden seconds it. All those in favor? Any opposed? Okay, we are adjourned. Folks, I need to take attendance really quickly. President Kuzmu. Vice President Chellen.
Present.
Vice President Woods.
Present.
Vice President Lay.
Present.
Vice President Lau.
Present.
Governor Kelly. Councillor Battelle. Councillor Borden. Councillor Mills. Councillor Hanwell. Councillor Bannister.
Present.
Councillor Schiavone. Still here. Councillor Mohammed.
Present.
Councillor Gruelke.
Yes.
Councillor Minarski. Councillor Valdez.
Present.
Councillor Corbett. Councillor Redmond.
Present.
Councillor Hamid. Councillor Morris. Councillor Nguyen. Councillor Champagne. Councillor Speakman. Councillor Hodgson. Mr. Raman for Councillor Wang. Councillor Zhang. Councillor Graham. Councillor Vinchin.
Here.
Councillor Douglas.
Yeah.
And I am here. Thank you very much, folks. We are adjourned at 10:19. Thank you.
Yay.
Thank you.
Hey, William.
Eric.